But what I have gotten backlash from vegans on Twitter is they say that your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan. And you know,
right.
If I hold on to my title after WrestleMania, I'm pushing for a hemp belt. I want to wear
leather.
Yeah.
I love
hemp
it.
Hemp belt to the ring.
This is your new WWE Championship. This is made from 100% sustainable organic hemp.
Oh my God! Okay, it's happening. Everybody, stay calm.
What's the procedure, everyone? What's the procedure?
Stay calm.
It's business time, baby.
The Solar Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
It is the Super Bowl Sunday edition of the Solar Monster Sounds Off, episode 584. Here for Sunday, February 3rd, 2019. I am the Solar Monster. Super Bowl 53 is tonight. It is the New England Patriots against the Los Angeles Rams. The Patriots are making their 9th Super Bowl appearance in 18 seasons. I can't bet against Tom Brady, although he can be beaten. We know that here in New York. Lest we forget Super Bowl 42. I still have my 18-1 shirt laying around here somewhere. I did enjoy wearing that for a while. They were the one, the Giants were, in 18-1 that year. But my prediction for this year is Patriots in a close game, probably by a field goal. I'll say 31-27. Although I might be looking forward more to the Big Lebowski ad than I am the actual game, or at least the character. I see he is reprising the character for a beer commercial. So that should be fun to see. Also tonight is the return of Halftime Heat. 20 years later, this time it'll be airing live from the WWE Performance Center. They are apparently holding a little Super Bowl party at the PC for the wrestlers and their friends and family, who will make up the audience for a 6-man tag, which is Aleister Black, Ricochet, and the Velveteen Dream against Tommaso Ciampa, Johnny Gargano, and Adam Cole. Vic Joseph and Shawn Michaels will be on commentary for the match. I'll still be stuck watching Maroon 5, as I will be at a Super Bowl party where they will definitely not be putting wrestling on during the halftime show. Maybe I can duck into the bathroom for 15 minutes and watch it on my phone. If anyone knocks, I'll just tell them the Hot Wings disagreed with me. That'd give new meaning to the term halftime heat. Thank you to everybody who continues to support the podcast via Audible. A lot of people listening to audiobooks courtesy of this show. You can get yourself a free audiobook right now. Just punch in audibletrial.com/solamonster. You can go through the sign-up process, sample the service free for 30 days. And in those 30 days, you get to choose one free audiobook of your choice that you get to keep no matter what, whether you cancel the trial or not. Just go to audibletrial.com/solamonster. We're off to a good start so far here in 2019. Let's keep it going. And if you are planning on going anywhere, commuting back and forth, we are heading in a couple of months here. A lot of people are going to be descending upon the New York, New Jersey area. A lot of people are going to be using Lyft, other types of services. If you do use Lyft or want to, for new users who sign up with a new Lyft account, if you use the code SOLOMONSTER, you can get anywhere from $5 to $10 off your first ride. So go ahead and punch in that code SOLOMONSTER. Get yourself a few bucks off on Lyft. And thank you to everybody who continues to support via PayPal. All our PayPal VIPs, I salute you. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout out here on the show. Gotta say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Pull No Punches Alan Ragasa, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan. And we have Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Stephen Handyman, Halistick, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Dark Sky Dixon Krasinski, Tim, Attack Before the Bell, DeWolf, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison, Soep, Jimmy the Mailman, Milstead. Haven't heard from Jimmy in a while. Today is Jimmy's birthday, so happy birthday to him. Defined Real. And a very special thank you also to Lorne from Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, who left a pretty thorough, pretty detailed review of the show, some kind words in iTunes. Very much appreciate you taking out the time to do that. Our Facebook Royal Rumble pool, this has been the sixth one, 6 years we've been doing this for, in the Solomonster Sounds Off private group on Facebook. We have never had a response like the one that we had this year. We had over 2,500 participants spread out across 81 total pools. And on Wednesday, I recorded a video to announce our first, second, and third place winners. I spun the wheel. We had a special interactive wheel of fun to select the winners at random. You can find a link to the video. It's in the Facebook group. I also put a link to it on my Twitter page, at Solomonster. It's about a 10-minute video, if you want to take a look at that. It is unlisted, though, so you have to find the link, because if you just go to the YouTube channel, it will not be listed. So just be aware of that. But congratulations to all three winners. I've already been in touch with all three. Your shirts are en route. Your prizes are on their way to you. I want to say thank you to Zach Holker and to Julian Cannon, and they will be the ones who will be sending you, one or the other, will be sending you your shirts, and my thanks to them for all their help, especially Zach. Zach is the guy who really helps put all this together every year. All the effort, all the time that he puts into it, I can't say enough good things about this. Zach is the man. Zach is the man. Well, Becky is the man, but Zach's pretty cool too, so thank you to him. But the third place winner was Doug Lippert, second place winner was Sean Pockris, and first place winner was TJ Pruce. Again, congratulations to all three winners, and let's do it again next year. That'll be year 7. Hopefully it'll be bigger and better. House of Glory is holding its Recapture the Glory show next Saturday, February 9th, at the NYC Arena in Jamaica, Queens. Jamaican me crazy. I don't know why I just thought of that. Bell time is 8 p.m. Pentagon Jr., makes his HOG debut, teaming with Phoenix. The Lucha Bros take on LAX. That's going to be a hot match. I might just get to call my first Pentagon match, which is very exciting. And the HOG Women's Champion Sonya Strong will defend her title against the Progress Women's Champion Jordynne Grace, title for title. You can get tickets at hogwrestling.net. House of Glory was featured pretty prominently in that training video that WWE posted on its YouTube channel for Sasha Banks. Leading up to the Royal Rumble, Sasha was back training with the Amazing Red, one of the owners of House of Glory. They've got a real good roster of talent. They're always a fun time. Hopefully I'll get to see some of you guys there. Thanks to everybody who watched my Royal Rumble review. It's up on the YouTube channel, over an hour long. A show that was longer than it needed to be, but overall I thought was very good. Over 5,700 votes in our Twitter poll. 75% of you voted thumbs up. Only 25% voted thumbs down. So I think we're all pretty much in agreement here. I think just overall that it was a pretty good show. It will be Seth Rollins challenging Brock Lesnar for the Universal title, and Becky Lynch challenging Ronda Rousey for the Raw Women's Championship at WrestleMania in the main event. If you are not subscribed to the WWE PC channel on YouTube, I don't know what you're waiting for. I plugged it a few months ago. I'll plug it again now. They have some amazing content on that channel. They posted some videos behind the scenes on a lot of the NXT talent at the Royal Rumble after they had been told that they were going to be part of the Royal Rumble. So there's videos. You show Matt Bloom and Sarah Amato inviting people into his office at the PC. Hey, do you know why you're here? Do you know the Royal Rumble? And they sort of build up to it, and you see everybody's reaction. And it's just really cool stuff. And they have a lot of really quality, like, personality profile type things on Matt Riddle and other people. So I cannot stress enough that you are missing out if you are not subbed to or at least visiting that YouTube channel. It's called WWE PC. It is a channel devoted to the Performance Center. A lot of out-of-character, behind-the-scenes type stuff. Just fantastic. So head on over there and sub to that channel. One man who will not be in the main event of WrestleMania this year is Dean Ambrose. I posted a Sound Off Extra on the Ambrose situation the day that The Torch broke the news on Tuesday. So if you missed it, I did almost half an hour on it. I would go back and check it out. Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch broke the story that Dean Ambrose has informed WWE officials that he will not be signing a new deal when his current contract expires in April. He will be leaving the company. I had the pleasure, by the way, of being back on Keller's podcast that same night. So talk about great timing. We did get to talk about the Ambrose stuff at the end of the show. WWE was quick, not too long after the story broke on The Torch, WWE was quick to confirm the news, issuing a statement. I guess it just blew up and they felt they had to address it. And they put a statement out saying as follows: Dean Ambrose, real name Jonathan Good, will not be renewing his contract with WWE when it expires in April. We are grateful and appreciative of all that Dean has given to WWE and our fans. We wish him well and hope that one day Dean will return to WWE. Dave Meltzer added in this week's Observer that Ambrose turned down a 5-year deal with a downside guarantee of just over $1 million per year. So this has caused a lot of people to scream, work, 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 work. Because WWE, they say, does not normally issue a statement like that. They thought the language was kind of weird and the fact that they would even announce such a thing so far in advance instead of trying to negotiate further with him and trying to lock him down and change his mind. And it got people wondering, well, that's a little suspect. And maybe it's just one big, elaborate work. This is professional wrestling. The only industry where you can literally see something with your own two eyes and still call it a work. Somebody could punch another person in the face and we can sit around having a discussion about whether or not it was a worked punch. You know, there's an old expression, believe nothing you hear and only half of what you see. So I get it. You have a right to be skeptical. I cannot sit here right now and tell you, I cannot sit here and guarantee you that it isn't just a creative way for them to give Ambrose something to do for WrestleMania. I can only tell you, well, first of all, A, look who we're dealing with here. This is not exactly the most creative bunch. That's number one. But I can only tell you that I don't believe this is a work. I do not believe this is a work. I believe they will use it for storyline purposes on TV. The fact that he might be on television, they might even address it, they might even bring up the fact that he's leaving the company. That would be weird. That in and of itself does not make it a work. I would be surprised, given how public they were about this, if they didn't incorporate it somehow into a storyline on television, possibly heading into WrestleMania. So just be aware of that too, that if they mention it openly on TV, that does not mean that it is a fake storyline. There's a lot of kind of blurring of the lines going on lately. We're seeing it a lot with Nia Jax, and I'll talk about that later too, where I think the company is using these things to their advantage. Hey, let's blur the lines. Let's confuse the issue a little bit and make people wonder, hey, I don't know what's real and what's not anymore. But I do not believe that this is a work. And I believe that when his contract is up in April, he is gone from the company. Now, he is certainly entitled to change his mind, but I don't believe that's going to happen. Now, as far as WWE's statement is concerned that they put out, there is a precedent for this. You know, when Kevin Nash gave his notice that he was leaving for WCW back in 96, WWE put out a statement about it. This was a whole 2 or 3 months before he actually left to go to WCW. I can vaguely remember reading the statement myself on WWE's old AOL site. Remember keyword WWF back in the day? Back when AOL keywords were the shit? You weren't a big deal unless you had a keyword. Forget having a website. You had to have an AOL keyword. And WWF did. And I remember them putting out a statement. This had to have been late February, early March. Again, my memory on the timing is vague, but it was definitely well before WrestleMania and his match with The Undertaker. And they publicly announced it because he had already, you know, either signed or agreed to sign. And so it was a done deal. There was no more negotiation left to be had, and they went and announced it. So this is not the first time that something like this has happened. It may well be the first time in 20-some-odd years, but you can't say that it's the first time because it's not. This has happened before. And, you know, first of all, as far as Keller goes, I believe in his reporting. Other sites have since stepped up to back up the report. WWE is making moves that would certainly lead one to believe that they're nervous. They are very nervous right now about losing talent to other companies. Mike Johnson of PW Insider said that there was a lot of activity backstage at SmackDown on Tuesday. That was the same day the Ambrose story broke. WWE executives backstage that night were meeting with different talents whose contracts are up in the next 12 to 18 months or so, trying to lock them into new long-term deals. I thought Bully Ray on Busted Open Radio had it right when he said the same thing that I think a lot of us are thinking. He read the same report from Mike Johnson and said, why would WWE be trying to sign everybody all of a sudden, all at once, to long-term contracts? What would move them? What would possess them to suddenly meet with all of these talents to try to lock them in if they weren't nervous about All Elite Wrestling and maybe Ring of Honor trying to sign these guys away? Everyone's talking about AEW. Nobody's talking about the fact that Ring of Honor is throwing around some bucks themselves. Don't forget, Ring of Honor is owned by a multi-billion dollar conglomerate. Just because they don't put a $1 billion budget behind ROH doesn't mean that they don't have the money to throw around if there's somebody that they really want. People seem to forget that fact. They don't talk about ROH as much, but you cannot discount them from the conversation. It's pretty obvious to me that WWE is nervous, and they have every right to be. If a guy like Dean Ambrose, who's been positioned as a top guy in the company in the past, now is suddenly going to be free to show up as he chooses at that first AEW show in May? You don't think they're going to want to load that show up? You don't think they're going to want to have a surprise or two up their sleeve? Launch with a bang at that show, Memorial Day weekend? If Ambrose sticks to his beliefs and stands his ground and doesn't re-sign, as of May, he'll be a free man. There's no clause, there's no non-compete. When your deal expires, you're free as a bird to fly wherever you want to go. There's nothing stopping him if he wanted to. Now, if they let you go early from your contract, that's different. You're probably bound by a 90-day non-compete. As far as anybody knows, that's not the case with Ambrose. And he's a guy that WWE has spent years devoting television time to. They've spent years promoting, especially as a member of the Shield. Who knows? Maybe he'll pull a CM Punk and he'll just disappear for a while. Maybe he'll take a year off, take his time to figure out what his next move is going to be. But for all the people who think, oh, you know, Vince McMahon isn't paying attention to any of this, you're not giving the man enough credit. He may be out of touch. He may be 70-something years old. His jaw may crack when he chews, but he is very protective of his company. He's no dummy. He knows what's going on. We knew that from the stories that Chris Jericho told about all the conversations he had and the text messages that went back and forth between he and Vince after he told Vince that he was working with New Japan. At first, Vince was supportive. When Jericho showed up as a surprise on that New Year Dash show after Wrestle Kingdom last year, what was Vince's response? Why did you do that show? I thought you only had a one-match deal with them. Or when Vince wanted Jericho to be in the casket match with The Undertaker at the Greatest Royal Rumble in Saudi Arabia. Rusev was in, but then Jericho agreed. And they announced the match, Undertaker versus Chris Jericho. Then Jericho told Vince about the New Japan deal. And 3 hours later, he got a text message saying, oh, the match was off. We're gonna go back to Rusev. The Saudi prince wanted Rusev against The Undertaker. That's what he says Vince told him. Right, sure. Uh-huh. Yeah, but these things don't matter to Vince McMahon, right? He doesn't pay any attention to this stuff, right? Sure. He's losing face here. This is what people don't understand. He's losing face. The more that these types of stories come out, He's losing face. It's less a matter of him being afraid of Cody and all of Cody's friends. It's more a matter of saving face. All these stories about unhappy talent and wrestlers asking for their releases, Dean Ambrose leaving the company. Look, it may only be in the grand scheme of things. They have a lot of talent under contract. We're probably talking about a very small number, a very small percentage of people. But the perception is that there's some kind of mass exodus happening of guys wanting to leave WWE. That's not something the company wants to have. So you can mock the whole AEW effect all you want to. And how, oh, they haven't even run a show yet. Yeah, they haven't. What does that tell you? That this is happening at a time when this company has not even run a single show. Now imagine when they do. If it's a success, imagine when they announce a TV deal. If it actually is a pretty impressive one. Imagine if that happens. WWE doesn't want to give them any help. They don't want to give them a leg up. The last thing they want to do is hand over anybody to them on a silver platter. And there's another angle to this that I hadn't really thought about, but I got an email from Kevin. And he thinks it's not so much a matter of WWE caring about AEW signing away their talent. He thinks it may well be more a matter of wanting to keep as much talent from leaving as they can should they decide to sell the company in the next couple of years. Now, the McMahons, they have answered questions about this before. They have not completely shot down the idea of selling the company because, let's be honest, it would be stupid for them to totally shoot down the idea. Why would they do that? What they have said is that they would be open to hearing offers if there was a serious one made. You know, if Disney one day came to them and say, hey, we want to buy WWE for $20 billion, that's not going to happen, but let's say it did. You know what? Vince McMahon might go, we can't turn down that kind of money. Sure. Absolutely. Let's make the deal. Who's to say? It could be Disney. It could be somebody else. Fox. But they're open. It's not out of the realm of possibility that the McMahons could sell the company in the next few years. You know, he said a few other things Kevin did in this email that I don't necessarily agree with. As far as signs that a sale is imminent in the near future, I don't think that's the case. But I think his larger point could have some merit to it. It's important for them to lock in as much key talent as they can, especially talent that's gotten a lot of television exposure on USA Network over the years. If there is going to be a serious offer made at some point about selling. Now, again, I don't think they will sell in the next couple of years like Kevin does, but I don't think any of this can be discounted. I still say this has way more to do with saving face and not losing talent to the new guys, because that would be super embarrassing for WWE. Every story about how this person turned down a big money deal wasn't about the money. They turned down big money. They're thinking about signing with AEW. Or every story that comes out about somebody who does get a big money offer, like a big money offer, and actually gets outbids WWE. Every story that we hear like that is extremely embarrassing for Vince McMahon. It's all about appearances. If it looks like the new lady in the beauty pageant is prettier than you, that's not going to sit well with you. They cannot afford to have it seem like something is wrong, that suddenly everybody is heading for the exits. They can't have that. Now, as far as Ambrose is concerned, what do they do with him? He's on the road. He will be at TV. I don't know if he'll be on TV, but he is scheduled to be at TV. Will he have a WrestleMania match? Will they keep him off the show? It would make sense for them to just sort of put him on ice. If they're convinced that he is not re-signing, his mind is made up and that's it, and he's going to be a free agent as of May, I wouldn't blame them if they kept him off television. Why give him a big payday? Why give him a big WrestleMania match? But if they do, based on what happened Monday night, there's two names right off the bat that they could very well program him with. He could have a match with Triple H, based on the interaction at the beginning of the show last Monday, or because they seem to be dipping their toe in the water and sort of testing the waters to see how the reaction is, To Nia Jax possibly being involved in some sort of intergender male versus female match at WrestleMania. They certainly did that at the Royal Rumble by having her in the Men's Rumble and having her, you know, eliminate some people and beat up some people, and then she took a bunch of finishing moves. Monday night, she's out there pushing and shoving Dean Ambrose. You know, when I did the Sound Off Extra on Ambrose, I mentioned the whole Nia thing, and I said, you know, I got to be honest with you, I'm no big Nia Jax fan, and I can't say that I'm all that interested in seeing Nia Jax against the male wrestler at WrestleMania, but if they wanted to do one last big match with Dean Ambrose, I can't say that there's another match, you know, that would involve him that would interest me morbidly, but that would interest me as much as a Dean Ambrose versus Nia Jax match would. I am not completely opposed to that idea. If they have a plan for it and they have an idea to build this thing up, maybe Ambrose borrows a page from the old Andy Kaufman playbook when he used to wrestle ladies down in Memphis. That was a gimmick that worked for him. You know, there could be an entertaining way, I think, for them to work a match like that. I mean, it wouldn't be my first idea, but I am not completely closed off to that as a possibility. We just don't know. We just don't know if what happened last Monday was just a one-time thing or if it's actually leading to something. So it's impossible to say. We have to wait until tomorrow night and find out if he's even on the show. I would encourage you, though, to go back and listen to the extra that I did on Ambrose if you missed it. I got into his career with the company the year he had in 2016 when he was white hot for a while and where it all fell apart for him. He gave a lot to that company. He was the workhorse there for a long time. He had more matches between the year 2015 and the beginning of last year than anybody else on the roster, including Roman Reigns. And that's with Ambrose missing the first half of 2018 with an injury. He had more matches than anybody else in that period. They have to be careful here for another reason. The Renee Young factor. Now, Renee Young is her own woman. Dean Ambrose is his own man. They have their own careers independent of one another. I get that. But if they play games with Ambrose on the way out, and I think this is one of the reasons why they've been, especially in their statement, they were very nice to him. They're very cordial. We hope one day he comes back and we can work with him again. They have to tread lightly here. They have to tread lightly here because if they play games or they try something underhanded to try to keep him when he doesn't want to be there, you know, again, they really value Renee Young. The last thing I think they would want to do is anything to really upset her and make her think twice about sticking around when her contract expires. And I have no idea when her contract expires. Could be this year, could be next year, could be in 3 years. I don't know. But the last thing they would want to do is fuck around with her husband and make her think twice about sticking around and working for people who would do that. So you can't say that, well, one really doesn't have anything to do with the other. It kind of does. And it all depends on how WWE handles the situation. I think they want to play nice with Ambrose anyway because they want him back. They already want him. He hasn't even left yet, and they already want him back. If for no other reason, all the money that I'm sure will be in the eventual, inevitable Shield reunion, probably in the year 2025. You can't do a Shield reunion with two-thirds of the Shield. Someone else who's not been happy with their position in WWE is Hideo Itami, who asked for his release this week after his appearance in the Fatal 4-Way match for the Cruiserweight title on the Royal Rumble kickoff show. He also later lost to Akira Tozawa Tuesday night on 205 Live, which may well end up being his final match for the company. Fightful.com broke the story on Tuesday. Tuesday was a big day. That Itami asked for his release. And the talk backstage was that his request, unlike the Revival, and unlike Mike and Maria Kanellis, despite what Maria said on Instagram, unlike them, it sounds like his request will be granted, pending a 90-day no-compete clause, because if they're letting him go early, they're not just going to let him go waltz into some other company. He's going to have to wait 3 months. He was said to be, like the others, very unsatisfied creatively. He's already changed his Twitter name back to Kenta. He posted one single tweet simply saying thank you, and a ton of WWE superstars have since tweeted thank you right back to him. Daniel Bryan even included a link to the match that he and Kenta had at Ring of Honor Glory by Honor 5, Night 2, from September of 2006, which, by the way, that match is posted free on the Ring of Honor YouTube channel if you've never seen it before. It is one of the best matches that I have ever seen live. Kenta was an absolute beast, and we never got to see him in WWE. Hideo Itami was not the same Kenta that people, I think, were hoping for when he first signed with the company. We got a very toned-down version of what made him popular, that style, that strong style that he was really known for. And yet, when he first debuted those first several months, he was over. He was over in NXT. He was popular. I thought they did a masterful job of building to that very first GTS spot. CM Punk had stolen his move, just like Daniel Bryan had borrowed his running knee. And Punk, you know, took the GTS, and now Kenta was here, and he wanted his move. Punk was gone, and he wanted his move back. And I'll never forget the reaction when he finally nailed Tyler Breeze with it at that NXT live event. It was WrestleMania weekend. It was at San Jose State University. That was the very first NXT event I had ever attended live. It was not a takeover show. This was before they were doing the takeover specials every WrestleMania weekend. I think they started doing that the year after. But it was an incredible moment. And, of course, it was only a couple days later he got a spot in the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal at WrestleMania. He was dumped out pretty unceremoniously, but he was the one lone NXT name who got a spot in the Battle Royal. After that, he seemed to be well on his way to an NXT Championship win in Japan at that Beast in the East special that summer. This was in 2015, and I still maintain to this day that would have been his spot. Had it not been for the injury, he had a shoulder injury, it would have been him, and not Finn Balor beating Kevin Owens to become the new NXT champion. I will firmly believe that until somebody proves me different, that spot would have been his. But unfortunately for him, he got hurt. I think it was in May. He suffered a shoulder injury. That's when they shot that angle in the parking lot at Full Sail, where he got laid out by a mystery assailant. We never did find out who attacked. I mean, obviously it was Kevin Owens. I mean, come on. Then Aleister Black, years later, gets attacked also in the parking lot at Full Sail. School safety needs to get their fucking act together over there. But he never recovered. You know, Kenta never recovered from that. I remember they made such a big deal about his signing. They even brought in Hulk Hogan for the signing ceremony at that event in Japan when they were over there, and when he signed his contract. And what a weird photo that is now to look back on. Hulk Hogan and Jimmy Hart in the middle of the ring in Japan holding Kenta's arms up like he's some conquering hero. But he got hurt. And then he suffered complications during his recovery. He ended up missing over a year. And that killed him. He was never the same after that. Even after he came back, it was only a few months later, maybe, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months later, he suffered another injury. He hurt his neck. Which is nasty to go back and watch. If you could find any of the video or the old tweets, people tweeted out video of the NXT live event. This was in October, I want to say, of 2016. It was on a botched power slam at the hands of Riddick Moss. And Riddick Moss is obviously, you know, very inexperienced. But they were working, I believe, a tag team match. And, you know, it's kind of that, not scoop power slam, but that snap power slam. You see Randy Orton do it. Goldust would do it in his matches. It was that kind of power slam. And Tommy landed right on his neck. It looked absolutely brutal. He's lucky. Let me tell you something. He is lucky. You watch that video. That he didn't get hurt a lot worse, a lot more permanently. But he did get hurt. And unfortunately for him, he was out for another, I think it was, what was it, 6 months? 7 months? And it wasn't even really his fault. It came at a horrible time because he was supposed to team up with Kota Ibushi in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. He had to pull out and he missed another 6 months. That's 18 months! On the shelf in total during his WWE run. And this is before he ever hit the main roster. 18 months down the toilet. I can't say that I blame WWE. You know, it was the injuries. The injuries derailed any real push that he may have gotten. He was snake bitten. It doesn't always work out for everybody. If they do grant him his release, because it's not confirmed that he has been granted his release. The talk seems to be that he will be, but I don't believe he already has. If he is, it'll be 90 days before he can go anywhere. I don't know if he stays stateside or if he goes back to Japan, but it sounds like we're about to see Kenta. Kenta's about to make his return. The question is he still the Kenta of old? Because if he is, I wouldn't want to be in the ring with him. No more so than I would want to be on the receiving end of a chop from Walter. I saw that poor bastard he wrestled in his debut on NXT UK last week. He left him with a handprint on his chest. But I hope he finds success again somewhere, and he stays healthy, most importantly. WWE gave him a chance, but the injuries just killed him. Creative wasn't all that great either when he came back. But again, I really can't blame WWE in this instance. You know, you can blame WWE about a lot of things, and they are an easy scapegoat. But in this case, I really can't hold it too much against the company. I don't even think that there's anybody to blame. It just, shit happens. This was just a case of bad luck. But as far as, again, where he might end up, Neville, look at Neville. He went back to Dragon Gate. Dragon Gate is where he, you know, that was his home. It's where he made a name for himself. And when he left WWE, it took him a while, but he ended up back in Dragon Gate. Maybe a Tommy is going to go back to his home. His home for so many years was Pro Wrestling Noah. I think it would be interesting to see him in New Japan as well. But we'll see where he ends up. Maybe he stays, again, in the U.S. Maybe he ventures back to Japan. Wherever he is, hopefully he can stay healthy and he can have another run. Because he's not, look, he's older now, but he's not that old. I still think he's got a good run and a lot of good matches left in him. It's just a shame it won't be in WWE. I don't know that AEW is a possible landing spot for a Tommy. But All Elite was in the news this week. At an independent show on Friday night, Cody, the Bucks, Hangman Page, SoCal Uncensored all appeared. The main event was SCU against the Lucha Bros, Pentagon and Phoenix, who hold the MLW tag team titles, and they could hold the Impact tag team titles too after their match with LAX that airs on television this week. It was already taped. I won't spoil the outcome. But after the match was over, the Bucks offered a verbal contract to the Lucha Bros to join the AEW roster, which they later accepted with a handshake. Chris Jericho later tweeted that both men had signed exclusively with All Elite Wrestling, which is not the case. Lucha Central says that that is not true. They are not exclusive to AEW. They will, however, be wrestling for All Elite once they start having shows. But they are still free to work Impact. They are still free to work MLW and any of the other promotions they currently work for, AAA. Being able to use Pentagon and Phoenix is pretty cool, but if they can eventually get them signed to some kind of exclusive deal, that would be a huge coup for All Elite. But just having them on their roster, I mean, they're working a lot of different places right now, but, you know, when they get TV, have Pentagon and Phoenix. You know, the thing about Pentagon and Phoenix is, as great as they are as a tag team, you can use them individually. They're great single stars too, so they're very versatile in that way, and they're awesome. So, you know, it's a win-win for whoever gets to use them. There was also a story this week about AEW, and I know a lot of people are going to roll their eyes, and a lot of people are going to shake their head. I kind of did it first, too, but there was a story about AEW having their sights set on Brock Lesnar, the reigning Universal Champion. Again, at first, I rolled my eyes, too. Look, I'm sure they do. They have their eyes on Brock Lesnar. Of course they do. Having your eyes on somebody is very different than actually signing somebody. That's a whole different ballgame. Chris Jericho supposedly is interested in having a match with Brock Lesnar, hence why he went and tweeted and then deleted. He took a shot at Brock having a big gut, which is kind of funny when you think about it. But I also laugh because it's as if Brock even uses Twitter. Like, whenever people tag Brock Lesnar, well, what's his, I think his official account that somebody set up for him is like Brock Lesnar DC or something like that. But I always laugh when people tag him in tweets as though he actually runs the account, as if he even has a smartphone. If he does, I guarantee he doesn't have Twitter on there. But people tag him in tweets all the time. Hey, at Brock Lesnar. Like, dude, he's not going to see what you're writing. I don't know what you're hoping to accomplish here. But yeah, Jericho tweeted and deleted. He's trying to stir some stuff up with Brock. And let me tell you why this is not as far-fetched as you may think, and why you should not be rolling your eyes. Brock Lesnar, if we know anything about the man, and most of us don't know really anything about him in actuality, because he's practically a hermit, right, when he's not actually on the road for WWE, which is very rare. We kind of joke about what it must be like in a day in the life of Brock Lesnar. He hunts, and he eats, and he hunts, and he eats, and he works out, and then he hunts again. I'm guessing it's probably not too far off from what he actually does in his spare time. But we really don't know, right, who the man Brock Lesnar is. But we hear stories and we kind of piece together the fact that if Brock is interested in one thing, I'm sure he loves his family, loves his wife. If he's interested in one thing, it's making money. Money is what drives the man. He did not grow up a fan of professional wrestling. He did not grow up cheering for Hulkamania. He did not grow up in the Carolinas watching the NWA. We know that much about him. It's something that he was naturally gifted at. He was recruited out of college. He excelled at it. He had a lot of success at it. He made a name for himself, made a lot of money, ended up fighting in UFC, made more money, came back to wrestling. For what? The money. It's the money. Now, if the Khan family is willing to put up the money and are willing to let him, let's say, do a UFC fight if he wants to, which apparently WWE has given him the right to do in his contract, if he ever desires, he can do a fight in the UFC while still under contract to WWE. I guess that was one of the concessions that they made with his last deal. But let's say the Khan family is fine with doing that and going to make him an offer. Yeah, you want to fight in UFC? Maybe we'll let you fight in UFC. Then there's at least a chance that when his deal comes due in a few months, sometime after WrestleMania, with the right offer, there could be a bidding war. A bidding war for a guy who maybe wrestles 5 times a year. It's good to be Brock Lesnar. But here's a guy who didn't like what a disaster his WrestleMania main event was last year with Roman Reigns, and chucked his title like a sack of garbage right in Vince McMahon's face. And was rewarded for doing so with a fat new contract. Anybody else pulls a stunt like that, they'd be Benoit from the company. Not Brock. He gets away with it. And no, I don't think that was a work. I think, you know, what they showed there in that footage on that WrestleMania special on the network where Brock came back through the curtain, threw the belt in Vince's face and kept walking off. You hear Vince yelling at him, you know, calling him an asshole. I get the sense that's just the kind of relationship the two of them have. But anybody else pulls a stunt like that, they're gone. That's it. Brock can do what he wants. He gets special treatment that nobody else gets. You really think this is a man who has loyalty to Vince McMahon? The guy who once fucked him over? All the lawsuits back and forth? They've put that behind them now. They've been doing business since 2012. All is good. They've had their fights. We hear stories from time to time about them fighting and everything, having shouting matches and stuff. But do you think that Brock Lesnar has a loyalty to Vince McMahon? That he wouldn't think about wrestling somewhere else if the money was right? If Brock even thought about signing somewhere else, you'd have Vince McMahon hugging his leg to stop him from leaving the way that Dixie Carter hugged Hulk Hogan's leg on impact. And I would laugh, too, by the way, if AEW ever did really make a play for him and their fans cheered the move. Because he represents everything that you would think that that fan base would be against. Guarantee you they'd be cheerleading the move. Bunch of hypocrites. But I will say this. I think the value, potentially, for AEW would be less in getting Brock Lesnar, and more and possibly being able to do business with Paul Heyman. That, I think, is where there could be real value for them, depending on how they might want him to contribute. Now, I think right now this is all fantasy land, but never say never when you're dealing with somebody who's only driven by money. If you ask me right now, how realistic is it that Brock Lesnar does business with the Khan family after his WWE deal is up? I still say there's a better chance that we see Brock Lesnar turn the universal title into his own sustainable organic belt than there is of him wrestling in AEW. But never say never. Raw last Monday night was live from Phoenix, Arizona. Over 3,700 votes in our poll, 43% thumbs up, 14% thumbs down, and 43% did not watch. So the thumbs up and the didn't watch were identical this week. In the Ambrose Extra that I recorded, I talked about the start of this show where he came out, he interrupted Seth Rollins and Triple H, and I actually thought Ambrose's interactions with Triple H was the most entertaining that he's been since he came back from his injury last year. Triple H made the match. Seth Rollins then went on to beat Ambrose with the stomp. And after the break, we see Ambrose sitting in the ring, not unlike Kevin Owens when he did the angle where he quit the company in an angle on Raw, only for him to be back on television the following week. He missed exactly zero episodes of Raw. But he was interrupted, Ambrose was here, by Nia Jax and Tamina. And Nia knocked him out of the ring, and then she and Tamina went on to beat Mickey James and Alexa Bliss to qualify for the Elimination Chamber match for the Raw, or the, I should say Raw and SmackDown, I guess, women's tag team titles. Sarah Logan and Liv Morgan of the Riot Squad, they also qualified later in the show. They beat Natalya and Dana Brooke. Serves her right for teaming with Dana Brooke. Ember Moon, unfortunately, will not be part of the Elimination Chamber match for the women's tag team belts because she is undergoing elbow surgery, and she is going to be out for several months. That likely takes her out of WrestleMania as well, so that sucks for her. Baron Corbin pinned Kurt Angle with the Deep Six. He then laid him out with the End of Days after their match was over. This sucked, by the way. This sucked. Although I have to think it is part of some kind of redemption story that they have planned for Angle heading into WrestleMania. It better be. Oh, it better be. They've already announced a segment for Raw tomorrow night where Kurt Angle is going to make an announcement about his future with WWE. We already saw him lose to Drew McIntyre. We already saw him dumped very quickly from the Royal Rumble last Sunday. He will mean less and less, Kurt will, the more that he gets used like this. This has to be the start of something bigger. But what? Where does this all lead? We know that Corbin and McIntyre are aligned now. Two of them injured Braun Strowman later on in the show. They gave him a double chokeslam onto the ring steps. Maybe all roads lead to a tag team match. Maybe it's going to be Kurt Angle and Braun Strowman against Drew McIntyre and Baron Corbin. Now, that doesn't sound like a WrestleMania match. That sounds like a Raw match. maybe an Elimination Chamber match. A pay-per-view, not actually inside the chamber. Maybe the end result here is a rematch at WrestleMania between Angle and McIntyre, where Angle either wins or at least loses in a very competitive match. Angle and McIntyre, they had some good matches in TNA before Kurt left. I know that was a few years ago, but, you know, maybe on a stage like WrestleMania, Kurt can go out there and maybe he does have one last great match in his body. I haven't seen that. Kurt has been okay. He has not been terribly impressive in the matches that he has had. Look, he's had a lot of injuries. He's getting older, 50 years old. It happens. This is not the Kurt Angle of old. But does he have that one last truly great match in him? That's the question. I think it's too bad that Jason Jordan got hurt. He may never wrestle again, at least not in WWE. It's a shame that happened when it did, because I really think that the eventual father versus son match that I think would have happened at some point, I think that could have been really good. You know, Jordan was really starting to come into his own when he got hurt last year. And by the way, there's no new updates on Jason Jordan. I know he's been to all the shows. I think he's been working as a producer, an agent backstage. Medically speaking, there has been no new updates on his condition. I have not read or heard anything about him coming back soon. If ever, we'll see. But as far as an Angle Jordan match goes, or WrestleMania this year, that's obviously out of the cards. And I just hope that whatever they have planned for Kurt, and it sounds like they're going to take the next step in the story tomorrow night. I hope it's worth it, because the way they've been booking him and treating him is beneath him. And if there's any sort of I don't know, drawing power or appeal, you know, left in Kurt Angle. Every time he goes out there and has a performance like this where he just gets finished off like nothing, like some jabron in 5 minutes or less, it kills whatever possible value he may still have. And if it is part of a larger story, then, you know, let's get to the next chapter, because what they've been doing with Kurt is doing him no favors. They made it clear on this show that Finn Balor will not be getting a rematch with Brock Lesnar. There will be no Beast versus Demon match, which makes what they did after their match at the Royal Rumble very confusing. Balor gave Brock a run for his money. Brock won, but Balor hurt him. He wounded him. He wounded the Beast. And for him to give Balor three more German suplexes and an F5 as sort of insult to injury when the match was over would have made perfect sense if the idea was that it, you know, helped awaken something within Finn Balor and he came back maybe as the Demon and they did a rematch at the next pay-per-view or they did a rematch at WrestleMania. That clearly is not the plan. So what was the point? What was the point of doing what they did when that match was over and beating down Balor even more? You know, was it really necessary to do that? The answer is no. They did it anyway. Instead, it's going to be Balor and Lashley feuding for the Intercontinental title. They're going to have a match on Raw tomorrow night. It will be for the Intercontinental Championship. Look, I think building to a Finn Balor IC title win at WrestleMania would be a good idea. You know, if he's not challenging for the Universal, the next best thing is IC. And I think it makes total sense if that's the plan for him. Elias. Elias is once again a heel. This after a very abrupt babyface turn a few months ago. Without any real explanation, this was back in October. Literally, I think the week after Roman Reigns announced that his leukemia was back. They lost their biggest babyface. And Elias was somebody who they decided, I guess, that they had to turn. Because they had, all of a sudden, they were down one babyface. And not that Elias is at the level of a Roman Reigns, but I guess they felt compelled to go ahead and turn somebody, and he was the one, so that was very sudden. But anyway, he was interrupted for the second night in a row by Double J, Jeff Jarrett. Jeff Jarrett was in the Royal Rumble match. They did a little thing at the beginning where Elias was number one, Jeff was number two, and, you know, they were talking and yakking, and Elias hit him with the guitar and dumped him out of the ring, and whatever. It's one of those, you know, dumb little Rumble cameos. I didn't have a problem with it. But then I heard Jarrett's music here on Raw. They're continuing with this. And out he came, and he called Elias Slap Nuts, which got a decent little pop. He started spelling out his name when all of a sudden the Road Dog came out, and he made a masturbation joke and got the crowd to yell, "Suck it." Somewhere there was a very angry GameSpot writer throwing his Xbox controller at the television during this segment. Then he and Jeff sang With My Baby Tonight. Road Dogg tried to get Renee Young to sing with him, but she didn't know the words. And Corey Graves mocked her for it. Corey Graves also claimed that Ric Flair won the 1992 Royal Rumble after entering from the number one spot, so he can sit the fuck down. As Road Dogg was walking down to the ring and singing his song, Elias smashed a guitar across his back. Jarrett went after Elias in the ring. He threatened him with his own guitar, but Elias hit him low, got possession of the guitar, and for the second night in a row, he smashed it across Jarrett's back. Jarrett has one of the best working punches in all of wrestling. Up there with Bret Hart, it's up there with Jerry Lawler, it's up there with Scott Hall. When I think of like great wrestling punches, those are the names I think of. Jerry Lawler, Bret Hart, Scott Hall, and you can add Jeff Jarrett to that list. I have to give him that. He threw a more believable punch than 90%+ of that roster. And I'm no big Jeff Jarrett fan, but I enjoyed this segment. I thought it was fun. I thought it was mindless fun, and so did the crowd, so that when Elias hit both of them with the guitar, the crowd booed the hell out of him for it. And I got attacked by a few people, not a lot of people, but I got attacked by some, for saying that this was a fun segment. I criticize something, I'm too negative. I praise something, I'm a kiss ass. If that's the case, I liked it. Bite me. WWE has since announced that Jeff Jarrett will wrestle on Monday Night Raw tomorrow night. He'll be wrestling on Raw for the first time in 20 years. He'll have Road Dogg in his corner for his match with Elias. You see, one segment with the Legends to get heat on Elias I thought was fine. Now they're going to drive this thing into the ground. It's like, you know, they talked about the shakeup. WWE shook up Raw so hard it knocked us all the way back to 1995. And in the WWE.com preview for tomorrow night, they refer to Elias as the treacherous troubadour. Oh, my God. Somehow, I don't think that's going to end up on a t-shirt. But my God, with some of these names. The treacherous troubadour. Jesus Christ. Tom Colihue is a freelance writer for The Torch. He says that he is hearing that WWE Creative is very disappointed that the audience reactions for Elias have not translated, as good as they are, they have not translated into any sort of real popularity for him outside of WWE shows. This despite the fact that they have put him in segments with some big names over the last several months, John Cena, Trish Stratus, among others. He says that there is a concern in the company that he does not have the charisma that they had hoped for, and that the stuff with Jarrett that they're doing now is something of a Hail Mary, and that he will not be featured as much on television if something doesn't change. If you remember, there was a concert last summer at the Gramercy Theater here in New York that was scheduled. They were going to have Elias, Walk with Elias in concert, and a few days before, they canceled the concert. And at the time, Brad Shepard reported that it was due to low ticket sales. You know, look, the thing with Elias is a very entertaining act on WWE television. It is not a mainstream act. They had him release an album last year. He put out 4 songs. It was a gag. They treated it like it was legit. And believe me, I've heard worse. I'm not even saying the songs were overly terrible, but still. I mean, what do they think? He's a real artist? That we should take him seriously? Did they think people would actually take that seriously? That his music was really that good or something? I don't get it. He seemed to be doing fine as a heel. All of a sudden, they turned him babyface. Now they suddenly turned him heel again. He was a babyface for all of 2 months. This company has the attention span of a 2-year-old, matched only by the fans, who seemingly have the attention span of a 3-year-old. But what did they expect from this guy? He was going to be the next Rock? Or John Cena? He's not! He is an entertaining mid-card act, even in WWE. Forget outside of WWE. In WWE. He's not main event material. Who thought that he was main event material? I've never seen him as a main event level attraction in this company. They think he has mainstream appeal? They have main eventers that don't have mainstream appeal. So I'm not sure exactly what they expected from him outside of WWE. That's just very bizarre to me. Then we had Ronda Rousey. After what I thought was a very good match that she and Sasha Banks had at the Royal Rumble, this was maybe one of her worst nights on television. She did redeem herself towards the end, but this was not going well for her. This crowd absolutely lit her up with boos. They gave her the Roman Reigns treatment from the night after WrestleMania 33 when they would not even let the man speak. Roman, that is, not Becky. This is the challenge that she's going to face from now on until WrestleMania. Up to now, the crowds have largely been very respectful of her. They've cheered for her. They've even given her the exact reaction that you would hope, and that I'm sure the company would hope, that she would get. I'm frankly amazed that they have not already turned on her, because it's the old, oh, you know, you don't deserve it, you don't belong, you're new here, you're being shoved down our throat. The crowds have largely been positive and have largely been respectful of her up to this point. But I think that's all about to change. Because now, she's up against the most popular star in the entire company. Not female star, the most popular star, period. In the entire company. In terms of crowd reaction, anyway. Now I'll get emails from all of the t-shirt Nazis out there. But if this segment is any indication of how Ronda is going to respond or react under pressure, she's in for a rough 2 months. She finally cracked at one point in the middle of all this. She stopped and said, "You got me. You made me stutter." And they just kept booing her. The crowd chanted for Becky until, mercifully, they sent Bayley out. Probably sent her out there a few minutes early. It's like a mercy killing. Bayley challenged her to a match. Ronda accepted. There was a botched spot towards the beginning of their match where Rousey, and I'm not really even sure what happened here, but she sort of slid into the corner awkwardly, and this was not her best match, put it that way. Of all the matches that she has had on the main roster, this was not her best. Bank statement by Bayley. Ronda, though, got the ropes, and Rousey got the armbar. She got Bayley to tap out. Long match, too. They probably went a good 15 minutes or so. But Becky was there, as it turned out, and completely unannounced. Nobody knew she was going to be there. She came out. She had her first ever in-ring confrontation face-to-face with Ronda Rousey. And this just felt like a big deal. This felt like, you know, when you have two guys, when they go face-to-face, especially before, you know, leading up to WrestleMania or before a big pay-per-view, and you get that big face-to-face confrontation in the middle of the ring. We got that here with the women. I don't know that we've ever had a women's match where we've had that kind of confrontation. And the match just felt as big of a deal as this one did. It felt like the main event. It felt like this was the feature match for WrestleMania. Not just that they're telling us it is, but it felt that way. And the crowd was going nuts for Becky. They were, you know, chanting her name, and she could just do no wrong. She could walk on water, and it was just pretty incredible. And unlike Seth Rollins, she said, "I don't need much time to think about who I'm going to choose as my WrestleMania opponent. I choose you," is what she told Rousey, and everybody cheered. Loud yes chants throughout the building. This is where Rousey redeemed herself from earlier. You could tell how angry she was. It was a combination of her, I think, being just devastated and really angry. And she was able to challenge, or channel rather, that anger. So when I say that she redeemed herself, this is what I'm talking about. She could have completely crumbled. And she did there for a while, but she was able to pick things up and recover nicely at the end. So I give her a lot of credit for that. But you could tell how fucking angry she was. And she told Becky, "I could kill you with my bare hands." She said that she realized the two of them were the same age, which means that when Becky was still training, she was headlining in a sport where they didn't even want women. Which is unfair, I think. It was Dana White who always said there will never be women in the UFC. There will never be women in the UFC. UFC is not all of MMA. Any more so than WWE is all of pro wrestling. But because those are the two biggest promotions, that's how people look at them. Oh, WWE, that's wrestling, right? UFC, that's mixed martial arts, right? A lot of people don't even know what the acronym MMA stands for. They've heard UFC. They don't know any better. So it's not that, you know, MMA was not welcoming of, you know, female fighters. I had always heard Dana White, whenever he would be asked about it, saying, "Nope, no women in the UFC." Except there were other promotions that had women that were very successful, and eventually they had women in the UFC. But Ronda called herself a household name, said that she owns the ground that she walks on, and at WrestleMania she's going to own Becky Lynch. And with that, she slammed the microphone on the ground, and she walked off. They never touched once. They got face-to-face, nose-to-nose, but they never touched once. I don't think they should, until WrestleMania. Maybe one of those shoving deals that, you know, the press conference, like they do at the UFC weigh-ins, or a big boxing fight. But that's it. I would not do any more than that. Let me pull this microphone in here. I think this thing is like a million miles away from me here. But this was impressive. I have to say, just about this segment here, what was impressive about it was that Ronda Rousey cut both the worst and the best promos of her career back-to-back all in one night. And the one thing that was crystal clear to me after this segment was over, it was crystal clear to me going into the show, it was crystal clear to me going back to the fall when I first said that this needed to be the WrestleMania main event, and it was even more so when this was over, that this match at WrestleMania needs to be one-on-one. I don't see how you can watch this segment from last Monday and think anything else. This is the match that people want to see. They're not clamoring for a triple threat match. And if WWE insists on doing a triple threat, I think Bully Ray had the most sensible idea, which is to make it an elimination match. That way you can get Charlotte out of there first. She gets to say, oh, I was part of the first ever WrestleMania women's main event, which you know WWE is just itching to get her in there so that they can say that Charlotte Flair was part of the first ever women's WrestleMania main event. You know that that's what they would love to be able to say. In this scenario, elimination style, you get Charlotte out of there first. She gets to be part of the match, but we also then get to see Becky and Ronda one-on-one. I still don't think that Charlotte needs to be in there. I would not do it. But that would be at least the sensible way of handling things if it had to be a three-way. That way Ronda can submit Charlotte, get revenge for her for the attack at Survivor Series. Ronda gets a win. And then Becky gets to beat Ronda and take her title. And everybody leaves happy. But based on what happened between Charlotte and Becky on SmackDown this week, it seems to me like they're heading for a match at Elimination Chamber. And if so, here's how I would do things. Here is, I think, the better way of doing things. They have a match at the next pay-per-view. It goes to a no contest, a no decision of some kind. Charlotte comes out on TV, she makes the case that, hey, I deserve this match with Ronda Rousey every bit as much as Becky does. Now, I'm not usually one for dumb babyfaces putting their WrestleMania title shot on the line before the big show. So what I would do is I would have the rematch at the next pay-per-view after that, which is Fastlane. A lot of people forget there's another pay-per-view in March. As if we need two pay-per-views between now and WrestleMania. We've got two. We've got Elimination Chamber, and next month we have Fastlane. So at Fastlane, you have a rematch between Charlotte and Becky. Only this time, instead of just putting her WrestleMania title shot on the line, which is stupid, here's the better way of doing it. What's on the line is an opportunity for Charlotte to be added to the main event, to earn a spot in the WrestleMania main event. Not that Becky would lose her shot, but that if Charlotte wins, it becomes a triple threat match. And you know that there would be fans sweating bullets, all pissed off. They're going to do it. They can't help themselves. They're going to have Charlotte win, of course. And she's going to be added to the main event of WrestleMania. Only not. Only in the end, Becky wins. Becky wins. And it's one-on-one. Becky and Ronda at WrestleMania. Now, what I love about this idea is you get not one, but two pay-per-view matches between now and Mania. You got to kill time somehow. These women are going to be on the show somehow. So why not get a couple more matches out of it between Charlotte and Becky? They had a pull-apart brawl last Tuesday. So there's still a lot of bad blood there. You kill two pay-per-view matches in the meantime. And in the second one, at least, there's something on the line. Something tangible. Something that people... Because if Becky puts her shot on the line, it's not realistic. Nobody believes that Charlotte is going to beat Becky and take her shot away from her. But everybody seems convinced that they're going to make this a three-way. I think it would be genius. You play off the fans' emotions, you play with them, you toy with them, you make them sweat a little bit, but in the end, you swerve them and you give them what they want. What it also does is it makes Becky that much stronger, that she gets a big, you know, just straight up win over Charlotte going into WrestleMania, and maybe they could finally put this to bed. Charlotte puts her hand out, says, "You've earned my respect." Because if they ever do want to do the whole horsewomen thing, they got to be unified here. They can't hate each other forever. Charlotte puts the hand out, gives Becky the endorsement, says, congratulations, you earn my respect. Now go to WrestleMania and kick Ronda's ass and take her title. That's what the fans want to see. By and large. I'm sure there's some people listening to this, don't count me in that, I want to see Charlotte. But you're in the minority, pal. You are in the minority. Most people do not want to see a triple threat match. And this, I think, would be the smart way to play things out. Now, as far as Asuka goes, oh, by the way, because she happens to be the SmackDown Women's Champion, she's kind of lost in the shuffle here. What do you do with her in the meantime? There's no great option, because on SmackDown, on the women's roster, it's so thin. And I certainly wouldn't call anybody else up from NXT, certainly not before WrestleMania, maybe after. I think the WrestleMania match is going to be and should be the rematch from last year's show. It should be Charlotte challenging Asuka. I've said, again, going back to the fall, going back to November, I've been saying that, not just Becky and Ronda, that it should be Charlotte and Asuka. WrestleMania rematch. My mind has not changed in the last 4 months. In the meantime, Asuka's got to defend against somebody. If Becky and Charlotte are all tied up, and Carmella's not a realistic option. I mean, I guess Naomi could be, because Naomi and Asuka used to be tag team partners. I guess you could do that. I can't say that really appeals to me. Lana, I mean, give me a break. You don't have a lot of options here. Except you've got Mandy Rose, you've got Sonya Deville, and you've got the Iconics. Forget the Iconics. I mean, they're better as a package deal anyway. Mandy and Sonya, they've done their own thing. I mean, it's not just that they're a team. I think you could probably get two matches out of them. One with Sonya and one with Mandy. Mandy's been pushed lately. They could probably get two pay-per-view matches, two easy wins for Asuka between now and WrestleMania. All the more reason to do Asuka and Charlotte at that show, by the way, because with Charlotte added to the main event, what the hell does Asuka do at WrestleMania? She doesn't have a lot of good options. Asuka should be begging the company not to add Charlotte to that main event of WrestleMania, even if that means that Charlotte beats her again. I know a lot of people are just incensed at the idea that Asuka could lose 2 years in a row to Charlotte. Yes, there's a very real possibility that's going to happen. But even still, Asuka should be hoping and begging to get Charlotte at WrestleMania, because there's no better option for her right now. But the money match on the women's side for WrestleMania is Becky Lynch challenging Ronda Rousey. It has been since November. Nothing has changed. And if anything, I believe in that even more so today than I did back then. Now, WWE has announced that Slappy McMahon has invited Becky Lynch to Raw tomorrow night, so she can lord over her in her 10-inch stilettos. Because if you're over with the crowd, you can bet your ass that you're going to end up face-to-face with Stephanie in the middle of the ring at some point. Now, if they're smart, Becky will be the one doing the slapping and putting Stephanie in the disarmer. Basically, the angle they did last year with Ronda and Stephanie. Ronda put Stephanie in the arm thing and broke her arm. And I say that they basically do the same thing here with Becky. And in doing the arm-breaking angle, that gives Stephanie a reason to ban Becky from appearing on Raw. That way you keep Ronda and Becky off the same show and apart for a while, because there's got to be some distance between them. Especially if you're not going to have them touch, which would be my idea. Look how many weeks of television you've got between now and WrestleMania. It's going to get old. You've got to separate these two somehow. Technically, Becky is still a SmackDown personality, at least until WrestleMania. Now she's got this whole thing going with Charlotte. They had a big fight last week. There's no reason for Becky to be on Raw. Let her beat up Stephanie. Let Stephanie say, you're banned from appearing on my show. And that gives Becky a reason to stay on SmackDown and feud with Charlotte through Fastlane. Then she could show back up on Monday Night Raw, the night after Fastlane. That's what I think would make the most sense. But the key thing about this angle tomorrow night, I know everybody is cracking jokes and worried. I'm worried too. Sometimes they do the right thing, a lot of times they don't. How many times have we seen Stephanie get in the ring, man, woman, child, doesn't matter, and she'll slap the shit out of him? Well, hey, if Stephanie slapped The Rock and she slapped Batista, and it's good enough for Becky Lynch, The whole point is Stephanie shouldn't be going around slapping anybody. Especially if they don't have a if they don't have the ability to fight back. It's just stupid. Vince McMahon would do things to people, but in the end, Vince McMahon got his ass kicked. Doesn't happen very often to Stephanie McMahon. She has a certain way of emasculating people. And since Becky calls herself the man, I guess you could say the same thing here. I'm worried that she will emasculate Becky Lynch on television tomorrow night. I actually think they'll do the right thing this time. I do. Call me naive. I think they'll do the right thing. But whatever they do, do not fuck this up. Don't do it. You've got a good thing going here. Don't fuck it up. That's my only advice. Seth Rollins interrupted Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman and punched Brock in the face, which I guess was his way of punching his ticket to WrestleMania to wrestle Brock Lesnar. I guess he made his choice, Brock over Daniel Bryan. And Lesnar then proceeded to hit him with not one, not two, not three, not four, not five. I sound like that guy in the old Ronco infomercial now. But six F5s. Nobody sells an F5 better than Seth Rollins, by the way. That I think was the fourth one he took. Just looked devastating. That being said, I can't be the only one who was bothered. I hope I'm not the only one who was bothered by the fact that after five F5s, five of them. I know that Roman Reigns kicked out of like six of them, but still, five F5s, which is Brock Lesnar's devastating finishing maneuver. Rollins was about to get right back up. He was pulling himself up. Hey, Brock, he's talking to Brock. He's having a conversation with the guy. You just got hit by five F5s, dude. Finally, Lesnar gave him one more and they went off the air. Five F5s was not enough to keep this guy down. After Brock has beaten nearly everybody else on the roster with one. I long for simpler times. Like when Psycho Sid powerbombed Shawn Michaels three times. Turned on him the night after WrestleMania 11. Powerbombed him three times. And Shawn sold it like death. Didn't move a muscle. Did a stretcher job, in fact. He wasn't even seen for 6 weeks. Sid powerbombed him so hard he came back as a babyface. If Rollins isn't in a body cast tomorrow night, I give up. SmackDown Live from Phoenix, Arizona. Their fourth straight night in Phoenix. Three of the four in that very same building. You could tell that they had been there for in that city for four straight nights from the photo I saw of the arena during the show, where one entire side of the building on the hard camera side was completely empty. I don't just mean by the Nest area where the hard camera is, like in that general area where you know, they don't have people sitting. I mean the entire side was full of empty seats as Becky Lynch was in the ring cutting her promo at the start of the show. So she's facing the hard cam, but it literally looks like she's looking at just a wall of empty seats. I mean, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, you just would never see that at a Monday Night Raw or a SmackDown taping. You also, though, didn't see the company running the same building 3 out of 4 days. But this isn't limited to just pay-per-view week. I can't even just lay the blame on, well, you know, it tires the crowd. People don't buy tickets at the end. That's kind of a cop-out answer, to be honest with you, because we've seen photos like this on non-pay-per-view weekends from other SmackDown tapings as well. You know? Although maybe none more depressing than the one that I saw here. At least I will say this, though. At least the people who were there were loud. They were loud for a good part of the show. The opening segment with Becky and Charlotte, I just got done talking about them. And, you know, I was surprised. I will say this. I was surprised that Charlotte did not call out Becky's Rumble win as being invalid in some way because she took Lana's spot in the middle of the match and Fit Finley waved her in. She wasn't really supposed to be in there. You know, like as a heel, it would have been easy for her to come out and kind of excuse her victory away. And that could be the impetus for a match. But she didn't say word one about that. That was not mentioned anywhere in her promo. That kind of surprised me. But they brawled. Charlotte attacked Becky's injured leg from the Rumble. Becky later got in her truck, and she bailed. She said, "I'm leaving," out of fear, basically, that if the doctors checked her out, she was worried that they were going to put her back on the shelf. She says she can't afford to go back on the shelf. And so she drove away. We had a very bizarre United States Championship match between R-Truth and the new champion, two-time champion, Shinsuke Nakamura. Just 2 days after regaining the title from Rusev, Nakamura was rolled up and pinned. It looked like a botch. Both guys immediately leapt up to their feet. I think Truth even went for an axe kick. The referee, meanwhile, is waving things off and saying, no, the bell rang. That was a three count. He hands the title over to Truth. Truth looks confused. Nakamura can't believe it. The fans don't know what to think. This whole situation was very bizarre. And this goes to the whole thing because the referees are told in situations like that, when there is a botch, to call it like a shoot. You know, make it, you know, it's got to look real. Call it like a shoot. I know one time, I don't know if they still do this or not, but when that policy started a number of years ago, there was at least a time when they were even bonusing the referees when they would do it for like a job well done. So I don't know if they're still getting bonuses for that, but I have not heard that that is no longer the policy. So my first thought was, well, that was clearly a botch, and they just made the best of a bad situation. Only from what I understand, it was not a botch. This was planned exactly the way that it played out. They just did a very good job of making it seem like it wasn't the plan. Weird as this whole thing was, I kind of like the idea of matches ending like this sometimes because, now, it's not the sort of thing you could do all the time, but at least it makes it feel more real, right? Like, the match can end at any moment. Poor Nakamura, though. You know, from winning the Royal Rumble last year, wrestling for the WWE Championship at WrestleMania, to wrestling on the kickoff show at this year's Royal Rumble, and then 2 nights later, losing his title to R-Truth. But the fans loved it, because R-Truth is still, after all this time, and all, you know, the portrayal of him is not somebody that you should really take seriously as any sort of major threat, or anything like that, from the Little Jimmy days to the comic relief they have him doing now, where he comes out thinking he's here for one match and it's the wrong match. He's very good. He's very entertaining, but he's not somebody that you are supposed to take seriously. He is a joke. He is booked like a goof. And despite all of that, and for as long as he has been around for, the people still love him. They are thoroughly entertained by him. They like R-Truth, and they were happy for him. So much so that when Rusev came out, people were getting angry, and they were booing because they thought, oh, well, I see where this is going. He's going to challenge Truth. Truth is going to accept foolishly, and he's going to lose the championship right back to Rusev. That's what I thought was going to happen. They had me convinced that that's exactly what was going to happen. But thankfully, that didn't happen. They did not play, well, I guess they are playing hot potato with the belt to some degree, but they didn't play hot potato that night and switch it more than once. Rusev and Lana did come out, and he couldn't believe that somebody like Truth was now the champion. This was a total heel promo from Rusev, who got booed, and it was almost like we were in a time warp, and it was a year ago when Rusev was still the heel, and talking like one and being, you know, booed like one. So we had a sudden heel turn for Elias the night before on Monday Night Raw, and here we have the exact same thing for Rusev on SmackDown. Two babyfaces, by the way, who the fans naturally turned on their own. I mean, the Elias thing kind of came out of nowhere, but the people were already starting to cheer for him. And I guess in this case, Vince says, no. Turns him right back. So Rusev demanded a match with Truth for the title. Truth agreed. Truth ended up rolling him up. I guess that's the only way he can win matches now. Nakamura jumped him after the match. They actually worked together, Rusev and Nakamura. I guess they formed an alliance of sorts. A new League of Nations. I think more than anything, the whole R-Truth thing, what the hell happened here? I think it's a small reward for a guy who has given a lot to this company, a lot of years to this company, and is still super popular with the audience. That's why he won the mixed match challenge. Him and Carmelo. Well, I mean, it was all the injuries. I think almost every other team, I think, in that tournament was ravaged by injuries at one time or another. So, by process of elimination, Truth and Carmelo were probably the only ones who went healthy the entire time. So, of course, they won. But the Nia Jax thing, which I said I was going to mention, you know, before, I saw the story about Nia Jax supposedly having heat because she legitimately hurt Truth at the Royal Rumble when she came out and took his spot and threw him into the guardrail and he hurt his face or he hurt his ankle or something, which you can't even tell if you watch the footage back. You don't see any of that. But this all got started because of something that Jerry Lawler said on his Dinner with the King podcast. He claims that Truth was legitimately hot about what happened, and he did get hurt, and he was in the back, he was on the warpath, he was looking for Nia. Look, I can totally buy, you don't have to pull my arm too hard to convince me that Nia Jax could hurt somebody, but this whole story just stinks to me. I don't buy it. Maybe somebody told King that. King was out at ringside calling the Royal Rumble when all this would have been going on, probably. Maybe somebody did say that to him, but I don't buy it. I think that this company is using past incidents to play up her reputation as being clumsy and dangerous. I saw her playing it up on her own Twitter, trolling everybody. She's using it to get heat from the fans. It's working. If you don't like her, or you don't like her using past incidents where she really has hurt people to get heat for her own character, to benefit her character, then don't give it to her. Don't engage with her. Don't play into it. If she did hurt Truth, I'm sure they made up very quickly, and they decided to play all of this up. But I think this story is much ado about nothing. I did get an email from Anthony. I wanted to mention this here. He suggested that the real reason WWE gave R-Truth the U.S. title, he also would like to think that it's a nice reward for his years of service and people like him and that's why they did it, but he believes that the real reason is so that they can have a black champion on both shows heading into Black History Month, which we are now in. The month of February is Black History Month. We've got Bobby Lashley, who only a number of weeks ago won the Intercontinental Championship on Raw. He's the IC champ. And now Truth has the U.S. title on SmackDown. Just in time for Black History Month. You know what? Given the company that we're talking about here, I think that there may be something to that. I think Anthony is onto something here. Again, I'd like to think that it is a little reward for, you know, his service and all that kind of stuff, but you're right. The timing is a little too convenient. Shane McMahon and The Miz celebrated their tag team title victory from the Royal Rumble. Shane said that it was a childhood dream of his to win the tag team titles. Oh, really? No love for that European title that he once held? Shane talked about how hesitant he was to team with The Miz at first, but that all changed when The Miz shared that story about longing to please his father and all these years and all the championships he won. Mr. Miz never once said, "Son, I'm proud of you." And that story touched Shane. And with that, Shane says, "I have a surprise." And he introduces The Miz's father, who was supposed to be on a flight home, but Shane had him come back, and out comes George Mizanin. He got a full entrance and everything. He cut his hair so he doesn't look like a Grateful Dead groupie anymore. The fans chanted Mr. Miz at him. I felt vindicated watching this. For years on this podcast, I have pitched for them, please, bring The Miz's father in as a character on this show, maybe even as a manager for his son. There's just something perversely entertaining about this guy, just looking at him. It's like the Ralphus thing with Jericho and WCW. Ralphus wasn't much to look at, but he was entertaining enough. I give Mr. Miz a little more credit than Ralphus. He's in better shape than Ralphus, too, I'll say that. But George is in the ring, and He tells his son that he loves him, and he says, "I'm proud of you." And the two of them embrace. Everything is set up perfectly for the eventual Miz turn when his father gives Shane a low blow. This is what I want to see. And then he can corner his son in the match that he has with Shane at WrestleMania. It has to end this way. Although, one of you, I'm sorry I didn't jot your name down, I forgot who, but one person did tweet me to suggest that maybe Miz's father turns on his son instead, as a swerve. And he declares that Shane is my only real son from now on. And Shane is the one who goes heel for the match. I did laugh. When I saw that, I did laugh. And the idea of Miz's dad turning on his own son would be gold, too. The problem with that is that that would make Miz the babyface in this whole scenario. And I just can't buy the Miz as a babyface for longer than a few weeks. He needs to be the heel. He was born to be the heel. But I guess, either one would be entertaining. I know some of you absolutely hate this and think it sucks. I don't mind it. I think it's a perfectly fine mid-card feud. Would you rather see Shane wrestling Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship at WrestleMania? Because you know that Shane has to have a WrestleMania match every single year. You know they're going to want him to have one. Remember when they came out on television a few months ago? We are the authority now. Bullshit. If we were the authority, one of the first decisions we would make is that Shane McMahon does not need a WrestleMania match. But he's going to have one anyway. You know it, and I know it. That's non-negotiable. Would you rather him wrestle main eventers? He's already wrestled AJ Styles. He's already wrestled The Undertaker. Is that what you want? Do you want The Miz wrestling Daniel Bryan for the WWE title at WrestleMania? There was a time when that's exactly what I wanted to see. Boy, did they beat that horse dead. They beat that horse so bad it died, they brought it back to life, and they beat it dead again. At least this way, you stick him in one match, middle of the show, give him 15 minutes, and it's over. Shane announced the four-way elimination match to determine who they would defend their titles against at Elimination Chamber. And it was the Usos, the New Day, the Bar, because of course it was. What other combination of teams did you think it would be? But this time they added Heavy Machinery to the mix. Boy, you know, these tweets that Sanity has been posting, which I assume is part of a storyline, or maybe they're trying to start their own storyline. I don't doubt that in reality, they've got to all be frustrated. Eric Young, Alexander Wolfe, Killian Dane, they have done nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I'm no Sanity fan. I didn't like them when they were in NXT. They just did nothing for me. They were just, I mean, look, I liked them more than I liked the Forgotten Sons over there in NXT. But I was never much into Sanity. But even I feel bad for these guys because they called them up and they did nothing with them. This is why all of these things are going on now. We have all these teams and all these people that are unhappy creatively and they want out. This is the Revival situation. At least the Revival gets television time. When was the last time we saw Sanity? That could be read a lot of different ways when I ask that question about WWE. We don't get to see Sanity very often in more ways than one. But it reminds me of the Sanity thing because I like Otis. I'm happy that Heavy Machinery has been called up and is getting television time. But if you're a member of Sanity, what must you be thinking? You were called up. How long were they called up? A year ago, maybe? Maybe more? They've done nothing with you? All of a sudden, these guys get called up? They're in the middle of a fatal four-way elimination match. Now, they didn't win. And it's very possible that Heavy Machinery will go the way of Sanity, and we'll see them for a few weeks, and then they'll disappear. But what must they be thinking? Sitting on the sidelines, watching these guys out there saying, "Hey, we were here first. What the fuck? Why weren't they in that match? Why do they insist on the same three teams every single week?" But Heavy Machinery was part of this. They did beat the New Day to eliminate New Day first. That was cool. That was good. And then they got eliminated by the Bar. Bar eliminated Heavy Machinery, Usos beat the Bar, and they are now the number one contenders for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. I can't think of a better team for Miz and Shane to face if they want to have as good a match as possible, so that's a plus. I think the Usos are the best team for that. Only question is, as far as I see, does the miscommunication and the loss happen at Elimination Chamber, or do they hold off on it until Fastlane next month? Because you know it's coming. Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville, they announced themselves for the Women's Tag Team Title Elimination Chamber match. Just like that, they announced themselves as being part of the match. First two teams on Raw had to win qualifying matches. Not these two. They think they're Bret Hart, apparently. Bret was the only guy who didn't have to qualify to enter the King of the Ring in 93. But at least they explain that by saying, okay, he was the champion, he got screwed over, so he sort of earned his way into the tournament. That whole tournament, by the way, was just designed to get Bret over. That was the whole point of the whole thing, and yet Bret didn't have to technically qualify. What's their excuse for not having to qualify? This was stupid. This was really stupid. And finally, we had Daniel Bryan in a segment 7 years in the making, unveiling his new organic hemp championship belt. If you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, if you have listened to this podcast for a week, you've heard the clip in the opening intro of Daniel Bryan. It's from the interview that we did when I was with Noah and Brian. We were at Radio Row in Miami, WrestleMania 28, back in 2012. And this was 2 days, in fact, before Bryan defended his World Heavyweight title at WrestleMania against Sheamus. That was where he was soundly defeated in 18 seconds. And in the interview that we did with him, he was talking about some of the hate that at the time he was getting from vegans on Twitter. And they were saying, you know, you carry around a leather belt with you. Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan. That's where that clip is from. 2012. And Bryan, in that interview, said that if I win at WrestleMania, I'm going to push for a hemp belt. Well, it took 7 years. You could have filed for personal bankruptcy and be able to use credit cards again now in the time that it's taken, but it's finally happened. Bryan finally got his hemp belt on SmackDown. He dropped the WWE title in the trash can, Alundra Blaze style. Rowan, who's just Rowan now, he's no longer Eric. He also has been stripped of his name. So now he's just Rowan, and he's got a recycling symbol for the letter O in his name on his Titantron. It's unbelievable. He pulls out of a small little velvet bag that he brought down a wood belt to show the world. He said the title is made from organic hemp and carved from a naturally fallen oak tree. PETA has approved the move. They put a whole article on their website, I shit you not, praising the move. Boy, are they going to be upset when he eventually loses that title and they bring back the mutilated cow belt. They may start staging protests at WWE shows. AJ Styles came out. Randy Orton came out. They were rushing to finish this segment because they have a hard stop at 10 p.m. on USA. Jeff Hardy came out during the commercial. Mustafa Ali came down. And then out came Samoa Joe. I haven't seen this many people victimized at once since Cena beat the Nexus at SummerSlam. They must have told Joe to hurry his ass up, because as soon as he walked out, his music hadn't even stopped. He was spitting fire on everybody in sight. He told Randy Orton, when I defang the Viper, it ain't going to come from out of nowhere. He told Jeff Hardy he didn't even know why you're out here. I already put you down. And when Jeff tried to respond, Joe told him to pretend that this was an AA meeting and shut your mouth while I'm sharing with the group. He so thoroughly destroyed Jeff with that one line. Randy Orton literally crouched down, he buried his face, and he put his hands on his head. Like a kid in school during a bomb drill in the 60s. He could not bear to look at the devastation. He called Mustafa a boy among men. He pointed out that he put his simple ass to sleep the week before on TV. And finally, he went up to AJ. He said, AJ, how's our old girl Wendy doing? And that was all he had to say. Styles attacked him. A giant brawl broke out. Brian and Rowan stepped outside. They were just observing. They were watching the whole thing. And Brian yelled, none of these guys deserve a shot at my title. Triple H then popped up on the big screen and said, you're right. No one person here from this group deserves to wrestle you for the championship. Instead, you'll be defending your title at Elimination Chamber inside the chamber against all five men. So now we know what both chamber matches are going to be. Brian, Styles, Joe, Orton, Hardy, and Ali. That is one hell of a lineup right there, I have to say. You know, you look at a guy like Mustafa Ali. Mustafa Ali went from 205 Live to pinning the WWE champion a few weeks ago on television. And now he's going to be one of six guys inside the Elimination Chamber challenging for the title. He is one of the great WWE stories of the year so far. And I'll tell you what, I am all for Mustafa Ali winning the Elimination Chamber and challenging Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship at WrestleMania. What a great story that would be. I mean, think about it. We've already seen Bryan and Styles, right? Countless times, right? We've seen so many matches between them. Bryan against a heel like Joe doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Same thing with Orton. Bryan and Hardy? I can't really see that being the WrestleMania match. So that leaves Mustafa Ali. Why not? Give me one good reason why it should not be or cannot be Mustafa Ali. He's the underdog. People like rooting for the underdog. He's also really good in the ring, which means we might get a pretty damn good match between these two. And apparently behind the scenes, Brian is one of the people who has really been pushing for Ali to be featured in the first place. Ali credits Brian, even though Brian won't admit it, to really going to bat for him and helping get him, kind of in the position that he's been in. I'm sure Brian would love to work with Mustafa Ali at WrestleMania. You look at the logical aspect of things here. Ali already has a pinfall win over him in a tag team match. We already know this match, whatever the WWE title match is going to be, we already know it's not headlining WrestleMania. It's either the women's match or it's Rollins and Lesnar, which I think it shouldn't be, but it's going to be one of those two. It ain't going to be Daniel Bryan's match. We know this already. What is the harm in having Mustafa Ali take that spot and challenge for the championship this year? Other than, you know, he's too small, So is Brian. The champion's a small guy too. So that means nothing here. Your argument is invalid if that's the only argument you have. Brian versus Ali is the match that I would do. I think Brian wins. But that should be the WWE title match at WrestleMania. As far as Joe goes, he's the best smack talker in wrestling right now. But he's got the Bray Wyatt problem, which is that he talks a big game, but he rarely ever backs it up. We saw that with the AJ Styles feud. He never did win the championship. He came close, but he fell short. And he lost, and he lost, and he lost. And it was going to be AJ and Brian at the Crown Jewel, and Brian wouldn't fly out to Saudi Arabia. So what did they do? They did AJ and Joe again, and Joe lost. He tapped out. Over and over we saw this. Now, I've made fun of Bray Wyatt before for the exact same thing. Now, I think Joe could overcome it because he's so popular, but he's got to start winning. You know, maybe they're gun-shy because of his injury history. He's had a few injuries, a few freak injuries. Maybe that's why they're ever, you know, they're kind of gun-shy to ever really pull the trigger on him. I don't know. But at some point, he needs to start winning. Or else all of this shit talking is just a bunch of empty threats. So the Elimination Chamber card so far, the two chamber matches, I just ran down the WWE Championship one. The women's tag team title one, we know Nia Jax and Tamina are in. The Riot Squad is in. Mandy and Sonya are in. And it's going to be three more teams, six in total. And I see now that WWE has added the Iconics, Billy Kay, and Peyton Royce. to the Elimination Chamber match as well. That came in a midnight update, a midnight tweet from WWE. Here's what I think is going on here. The more I think about this, I talk about how thin the SmackDown women's roster is. I just don't think they have enough women to do all these qualifying matches. And so what they're doing on the SmackDown side, people are just getting in. That's what I think is going on here. And that will crown the new women's tag team champions. We have Miz and Shane defending against the Usos. Those are the only official matches so far. It looks like Charlotte and Becky are probably going to have a match. I would think Mysterio and Andrade Cien Almas look like they're headed for another match as well. And I would say Balor and Lashley. They're having a match tomorrow night, but I think that builds to an IC title match. So, you know, looking on paper, it looks like a pretty solid card so far, but we're still a couple of weeks out.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
I didn't mention this Sam Roberts situation when I did my TakeOver review last week, but this is still a story apparently, so I wanted to comment on it. For those who don't know, Sam was part of the pre-show panel. They invite him for a bunch of these pre-show panels before the pay-per-view events, you know, each year. I don't know if it's every month or not, but he's been doing that for a while now. And so he was on the pre-show panel for the NXT TakeOver show in Phoenix. It was Charlie Caruso, Sam Roberts, and this guy Pat McAfee. And when previewing the NXT women's title match between Shayna Baszler and Bianca Belair, Sam went off on how Belair didn't deserve to be getting a championship match and how it was a waste of a match. Everybody knew she stood no chance against Shayna and how she just wasn't ready for that spot. And it wasn't said in a way like, oh, like a total, you know, work way where she's outmatched physically and she doesn't stand a chance. It was said in a way where she's inexperienced and she doesn't deserve this spot now. It's too early. And that was basically what he was saying. He said she might be one day, but why is this match even happening? It's a waste, is what he said. Now, I thought nothing of it because it just screamed work to me. Now I sound like all the Ambrose naysayers out there. But this to me just screamed staged. And if you go back and you watch, you can literally see the moment that Sam pauses when they go to him for his opinion. Like he's got someone going off in his ear. He stammers, he mumbles around for what felt like forever. I mean, before finally going off on Bianca, there was... Go back and watch that. It's actually kind of funny to watch. Either he had somebody in his ear, or he was having a stroke. I don't know. But it was very weird. People apparently were very upset about this. And when I say people, I mean like on Twitter, you look through some of the comments, some people claimed it was a racial thing, it had racial overtones. I guess because she's African American, what are you saying? She doesn't deserve the spot. He didn't say this about anybody else. He only said this about Bianca Belair. Give me a break on that. I don't buy that for a second. That's bullshit, and I don't want to hear that. Other people said that it was just disrespectful for him to say the things that he said and that he was out of line. And he needed to apologize to Bianca for what he had said. Bianca, when she was asked about it after the match, she was doing her post-match interview. And I don't remember if it was, it wasn't Charlie, it was one of the other, unknown female, number eight, or whatever, interviewing her, asked her about it. She said, you know, by the way, Sam Roberts on the pre-show had this to say about you, do you have anything to say to him back? And she called him Mr. Sam and said that he could kiss her ass. And she walked off. Again, I'm watching this thinking, okay, it's all part of the plan here. You know, they're trying to stir something up between Sam Roberts and Bianca Belair. I have no idea why, but okay, fine. It just seemed very well orchestrated to me. And it got people talking, which I figured was the whole point. His name was trending on Twitter for a while that night and the whole thing. Now, for his part, on his podcast, Sam talked about it. He addressed the situation. He claims it was not a work. He says that there was nobody in his ear telling him what to say. He says that he refuses to apologize for having an opinion. This is what I'll read just what he said here. And hat tip to WrestleYard.com for the transcription on this. He said, WWE invites me to those kickoff shows, and they ask me to give my opinion on things. On Saturday night, I was not fed any opinion in my ear. I know that's one of the theories. I have never been fed an opinion in my ear. They would not bring me to give their opinion. I'm no good at that. I go on, they ask me to be me, and I give my opinion. I had a crisis of conscience. In that moment, I felt like I was just going along with the show, so I decided to say exactly how I felt in that moment. I know Mark Henry has started a campaign saying I owe Bianca an apology. I certainly will not be apologizing to Bianca Belair because my opinion is my opinion. Do I think that she deserves to be a takeover after her performance? You'll have to ask me at the end of March. The next takeover is in April. I will tell you in April if Bianca Belair, in my opinion, deserves to be a takeover. But I found that match at the beginning of Takeover. It felt underwhelming to me, and so I talked about it. There were people after the show who had conversations with me about the way that I said what I said, but the fact is that I said it, and it is what it is. It's exactly as you saw, and that's kind of it. Was everybody thrilled with it? No. That's what I mean about having conversations. But those are, again, maybe things that I don't want to exactly get into at the moment. However, we'll see how things go as we move forward. So that's his side of the story, in his own words. He was not told to say what he said. He had a crisis of conscience in the moment, which I guess might explain why it sounded like he was stroking out there for a few seconds. If he did say that of his own volition, I happen to think he was wrong. Not that he said it, but in his actual opinion that it was a waste of a match. That was one of the matches I was actually most looking forward to that night. When it was over, it was pretty apparent to me that she is going to benefit, I think, from spending more time in NXT. She'll get better, and not that she had a bad match, just that it was obvious she's still very inexperienced. But I thought she did a good job, and hopefully they will, you know, keep her down there a while and she'll improve. And I still think that she's got superstar written all over her, just not right now. So, was it a waste of a match going in, and she didn't deserve to have a takeover match? I don't agree with that at all. However, if he is telling the truth, and look, we could still be getting worked here, but if he's telling the truth, and he is getting shit for being honest and giving an opinion, people need to back the fuck off. The man is entitled to have an opinion. I don't have to agree with that opinion. You don't have to agree with that opinion. Bianca Belair does not have to agree with that opinion. But he doesn't owe her any apology. And I wish there was more honesty from people on these shows. Not just Sam. I wish there was more honesty from people on these shows. And on commentary. And that all of these opinions didn't sound so phony and manufactured and scripted. He doesn't owe anybody an apology. And I would hope that even if you don't care for Sam Roberts, you know, he does. Not everybody's a Sam Roberts fan, that I would hope we can at least agree on that. That if he was giving an honest opinion, he should have the right to do that. And if WWE doesn't like that, then they don't have to invite him back on their shows. They can wish him well in his future endeavors. Now, if they do invite him back and he starts giving even more controversial opinions, I think that'll be a telltale sign that we'll know that this is all just part of a gimmick, a new gimmick to create controversy. But if he's telling the truth, he's entitled to speak his mind no differently than Charles Barkley does on those NBA on TNT shows. I saw him ripping on the Lakers the other day about the Anthony Davis thing and how if they trade him there, he wants the commissioner, the NBA commissioner, to block the move. As sure as he lives, breathes, and eats, you can expect Charles Barkley to shit on the LA Lakers any chance he gets. But the rare times that I do watch him on there, I never think, oh boy, this guy sounds like he's reading off a teleprompter. Of course not. I'd like to see more people express themselves honestly on these kickoff shows. Then they might actually be worth watching. They taped two matches before the takeover show that aired on television this week. The Sky Pirates, Kairi Sane and Io Shirai, beat Marina Shafir and Jessamyn Duke in Sane Elbow for the win. You watch this match and you realize how premature all this talk really is about any kind of horsewomen versus horsewomen match. If they ever do the match, it's still a ways off. These women aren't close to being ready for that kind of spot. Not even close. I know I said Survivor Series this year is when I would target for it, but even that might be a very conservative estimate. This is even assuming that Ronda Rousey is around and doesn't take some kind of extended break. And the Forgotten Sons, Wesley Blake and Steve Cutler, beat the Street Profits. Crowd chanted, "We forgot you," at Blake and Cutler. Montez Ford hit this unbelievable dive out over the top rope and onto Cutler outside the ring. Like, the height that he got on this vertical leap was incredible. You don't even need to watch the rest of this. Just go on my Twitter. I retweeted this clip that somebody posted of that one spot of him doing that dive. That's all you need to see. Jackson Ryker, the former gunner from TNA, he was outside. He clotheslined Ford, and he ended up, he rolled back into the ring. They hit him with their finish, the Forgotten Finish. Literally, I forgot. I don't know the name of it. I forgot. I've said this before. I'll say it again. I just can't get into these guys. But I do look forward to the day they get called up, lose in their very first match, and then get used sparingly on television until Cutler gets fed up and he bolts for All Elite Wrestling, where he does dick spots with Joey Ryan. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jonathan from Ireland. I'm traveling over for my first WrestleMania this year. Will you be having a meetup? Great question. Yes, I would very much like to have a meetup. I do them every year. Usually multiple times a year. We just did one for SummerSlam weekend here in Brooklyn. SummerSlam is not going to be back in Brooklyn this year, but WrestleMania is, or at least the shows around WrestleMania. And that week is going to be insanely crazy. And so this is not confirmed yet, but I want to put this out there now. And I want to get feedback from you guys to see if this works for you or not. It won't work for everybody, but if it works for the majority of people, this is what we'll do. Right now, what I'm aiming to do, not a live show. I did that a few years ago in, was it Dallas? Dallas, Houston? I don't know why I get the two confused. Dallas or Houston, whichever WrestleMania that was. I don't even remember. I mean, those are two pretty big cities. You would think I would remember, but wherever WrestleMania 32 was, it was the Monday after. It was great, too. Just logistically, it's a challenge to do a live show. I don't think it's going to work out this time, but I want to at least have a meetup. And my plan is to do something the Friday before WrestleMania. That's April 4th. A few hours before the NXT TakeOver show in Brooklyn. Now, the show is at the Barclays Center, and we would do the meetup a few blocks away. This would be our usual spot, the KBH, a few blocks away from the Barclays Center. That way, when it's over, when our meetup is over, whoever's going to the TakeOver show can just walk right over. Like, I'm going to the show, so I'm going to walk right over. So, that's my question to you. How does that sound? Does that sound doable? Because I think that's going to be the best solution to this. There's just so many different things going on. I say Friday because Saturday is just going to be impossible for me. Sunday, of course, and then Saturday night is the ROH New Japan show at Madison Square Garden. Sunday is WrestleMania. That ain't going to work. There's just not going to be time. So I've thought about this, and I think the Friday before is probably what makes the most sense. And you got to watch, too, you know, when it comes to getting out to Jersey. It'd be a lot easier if WrestleMania was actually in the, like, if they had a stadium in the middle of Manhattan. I mean, it would create a traffic nightmare, but boy, that would make life a lot easier as far as getting to and from the show. And instead, you got to go out to Jersey to get to the stadium. Sunday is just going to be out of the question. But you guys let me know. You can send me a tweet, send me an email, post on Facebook or what have you. And I will review all of your feedback. And if for some reason it's a problem, then we won't do it. We'll try to figure something else out. But I'm thinking that Friday is probably going to make the most sense. And maybe even before Raw, you know, that Monday, Raw's going to be at the Barclays Center. I wouldn't be against having some kind of a little informal meetup even again, you know, before Raw. But let me know what you think. The main one, looking at Friday, if I had a guess, I'm probably, you know, probably like 2 o'clock or so. Show starts at what, 8? 7:30? People start getting to the arena at 6. I think that's plenty of time. And so that is what I am thinking right now. You guys will let me know. Brian, in Richmond, Virginia, I'm binging on Saturday night's main event shows on the network and wanted to know which episode or match you would recommend or think is the best. I watched the Hogan Bossman cage match from 89, and it was better than I expected, especially with the big superplex spot. That was crazy. They did that spot on all the house shows. They did like a whole house show loop in the spring of 89. And they did that superplex spot where Hogan superplex Bossman from the top of the cage night after night. It got over real big. Of course, Hogan's had 9 back surgeries since then. So I'm sure that didn't help. Rockers and Brainbusters, they had some really good matches on Saturday night's main event. I think they had a couple. If you want to see one of the best 10-minute matches you'll ever see, my pick is the Mr. Perfect Tito Santana match for the Intercontinental title from the Saturday night's main event that aired in July of 1990. I have praised this match before. It is the match, one of the greatest matches, I think, in Saturday night's main event history that doesn't really get talked about. It's a very underrated match because it doesn't have big, big names in it. I mean, Perfect was a name, but he wasn't like a main event guy. And it's, again, like a 10-minute match. It wasn't like there was a big title change. I'm sorry for the spoiler, but whatever. It really is an underrated match. It's a very good match. Do yourself a favor and go find it. It's just, you know, great classic old school wrestling. Hot crowd. Really made you believe. Did a good job of making you believe that Tito had a shot at taking that title. You know, Tito was always really popular, Tito Santana. Sometimes I think even more so than the push that he was getting. He was very popular, and I would also say, by the way, if you're fishing around on YouTube, because I don't think it's on the network, go find the match that he had with The Undertaker. It's definitely either on YouTube or on Daily Motion. He had a match with Undertaker in 1991. It must have been on an international tour. They were in Barcelona, Spain. And they had a match, and it was The Undertaker's first defeat, his first pinfall loss in WWE. Of course, it didn't air on TV here, so I guess it doesn't count. But that would have been the first time, I believe, that Undertaker would have been pinned in his WWF run. And of all people, it was Tito Santana who got the pin. But boy, you got to watch this, because when he covers him for the 3 count, I think he hit him with the urn. When he covers him for that 3 count and the ref hits 3, you watch that crowd. You just do not see stuff like that anymore. But Perfect and Tito would be my recommendation. Christopher from San Mateo, California. I was watching some old promos by New Jack and Mustafa, the Gangsters, when I came across a video of them at a graveyard promoting a match against The Undertaker, of all people. I know Undertaker wrestled a few Smoky Mountain Wrestling shows, but didn't know how, at one point, he was in the same ring with New Jack. What was the story behind this bout, and why can't I seem to find footage of the match? Well, you blew my mind with this one. I had no idea that Undertaker and New Jack ever shared a ring together. And I'm with you. I must see this now. I could not find the footage. I searched high and low. I searched YouTube. I searched Daily Motion. I could not find any footage, not even clips, of the match. And actually, it was more than one match. They shared the ring for 2 matches. I couldn't find footage of it. I did see the skit that you mentioned in the graveyard. It is up on YouTube. It's very corny, but it's just weird to see New Jack. They got this really corny like background, like, ooh, spooky music. And New Jack has a shovel in his hand, and he's cutting a promo on The Undertaker. And D'Lo Brown is with them, and he's all scared. And Mustafa's there, and he's all scared. And Tracy Smothers, in one of his shoot interviews, talked about the matches because he was part of them. He teamed up with The Undertaker for both of the matches, back-to-back nights. They were in April of 1995. This was literally the week after WrestleMania 11, when Undertaker had that horrible match with King Kong Bundy. They had fucking Larry Young as the referee for the match. He was a baseball umpire. This was during the baseball strike in 95. I wish Undertaker and Bundy would have gone on strike so we didn't have to watch that match. But it was actually two matches that Undertaker worked against the Gangstas on back-to-back nights. He wrestled a few more matches for SMW throughout the year. He wrestled Unabomb, who would go on, of course, to become Kane many years later. But SMW was Jim Cornette's promotion. Vince basically loaned out the Undertaker for a few appearances, not unlike what he did for Jerry Lawler in 93. He not only did Vince let his talent wrestle in Memphis for Lawler's promotion in 93, Vince himself made appearances in Memphis as a heel. He cut heel promos and actually went for a match. He didn't wrestle in it, but he was ringside for a match in Memphis. It's just so bizarre. And you can find all of that Memphis stuff on YouTube. At one time, somebody had them organized, like in chronological order. You know, Brett and Owen were there. They were cutting promos, making fun of all the Hick fans in, you know, Memphis, Tennessee. And Tatanka was there. And it was just bizarre. Very, very bizarre stuff. But anyway, WWE does have some Smoky Mountain on the network. Nothing from 95. So I did some research. I dug up an old Observer, and I dug up an old Torch newsletter from April of 1995. When all else fails, you go to the newsletters back then, which used to have all the fan-submitted reports from all around the country that you couldn't just get on the internet back then. And sure enough, they both have reader reports from both of these shows. The first one was their Bluegrass Brawl. Bluegrass Brawl 3 from April 7th in Pikeville, Kentucky. It was The Undertaker with Paul Bearer teaming with Tracy Smothers against New Jack, Mustafa, and D'Lo Brown. Bob Armstrong, Bullet Bob, he was supposed to team with Undertaker and Smothers. He was taken out before the match started. I think he was sick or something, so they did an injury angle. They took him out of the match right before. So it was a handicap match. It was Undertaker and Smothers in a handicap match. And Undertaker pinned D'Lo. The Gangstas were then forced to salute the rebel flag. Undertaker brawled to the back with somebody, and they did a heel beatdown angle in the ring to end the show. The next night was in Johnson City, Tennessee. It was SMW Fright Night. Again, main event, Undertaker, Bob Armstrong, Tracy Smothers, against New Jack, Mustafa, and D'Lo Brown. It was an I Quit match. Undertaker got a gigantic reaction. This is the report from the Torch. I'll just read it to you here, since we can't watch this thing anywhere. I guess this is the next best thing. The Gangstas acted scared to death of the Undertaker. New Jack produced a cross, which he used vampire style to try to frighten the Undertaker, but Undertaker simply took the cross out of his hands. Smothers started for the babyface team. Moments later, the place went nuts when he tagged out to the Undertaker, who cleaned house on all of the terrified heels. For the finish, Undertaker pinned D'Lo with a tombstone pile driver. Bullet Bob then tagged in, submitted D'Lo with a spinning toe hold. The days when a spinning toe hold could be used for a submission. New Jack tried to flee, but Undertaker gave him a tombstone pile driver after the match. This person gave the match, by the way, 3¾ stars, which is better than I would give that AJ Styles-Daniel Bryan match at the Royal Rumble. Add that to the list of things I thought I'd never say. I have to see this. I have to find footage of New Jack holding up a cross to the Undertaker like he's Dracula. It just feels so out of place. Like, having a character like that in there with all those good old boys and two guys like the Gangstas. And look at the other names on the card, like Dirty White Boy and the Rock and Roll Express. And then here's this undead zombie man. Like, but hey, he got the biggest reaction of anybody that apparently who's ever wrestled in that city up to that point. So it worked. Never underestimate the power of being a star on television.
What did we just see? What did we just see? It's WrestleMania, baby!
When one countdown ends, another begins. You guys seem to enjoy the Royal Rumble countdown so much, as did I, that I thought I would do another one for the next 10 weeks to carry us right into WrestleMania Sunday. And why not make it WrestleMania themed? But I didn't want to just do the usual, oh, you know, top 10 best WrestleMania matches, or, you know, best WrestleMania pay-per-views, best WrestleMania title wins. Everybody's done that. That's played out. Instead, I have ranked what I believe are the top 10 most shocking WrestleMania match outcomes. Now, this could mean shocking as in who won the match, shocking as in something that happened during the match that led to the finish, maybe something that happened post-match. You can define shocking a bunch of different ways, I suppose. But this is a ranked list that I've put together, and this week we are going to kick things off with number 10 in the countdown. Ravishing Rick Rude defeats the Ultimate Warrior to win the Intercontinental Championship at WrestleMania 5. Warrior won the title at SummerSlam the year before. He beat the Honky Tonk Man in 30 seconds. 14-month run for the Honky Tonk Man as the IC champ. It took 30 seconds for it to come to an end. Rude challenged the Warrior to a super pose down at the Royal Rumble in 1989, which was used to set up their match at WrestleMania, as it turned out. So they have this super pose down, and Bobby Heenan's in there. He's rubbing baby oil on Rick Rude, and he's posing, and the Warrior, of course, just looks completely ridiculous. He's just jacked to the gills. And Rude is all cut up, too. I mean, you can tell. I mean, his waist was like 2 inches. I mean, this guy looked like he was chiseled out of granite, but the Warrior was just in a completely different league. And so Warrior outposes him. It was, you know, fan reaction. Based on fan reaction, the fans, of course, are cheering the Warrior. They're booing Rude. And so Rude assaults him with a workout bar. Actually, what happened first, let me backtrack here. Bobby Heenan, he sprayed something, I'm pretty sure it was baby oil, right in the Warrior's eyes as he was posing. I think the idea was that he would spray Warrior in the eyes, he would be blinded, and then Rude would attack him with the bar from behind. Instead, Heenan sprays this stuff, it goes right into Warrior's eyes, and the Warrior just no-sold the whole thing. He just stood there. He had this shit sprayed right in his eyes. He just kept posing until Rude waffled him right over the back of the head with this warm-up bar. And anyway, fast forward, he's choking him out with it. He leaves the Warrior laying. Of course, the Warrior ended up powering back to his feet and running like a maniac to the back. Fast forward to WrestleMania 5. Trump Plaza, Atlantic City, their second straight year at Trump Plaza. They face off for the IC title. They had a decent match. It's fine. They would have a much, much better match at SummerSlam that year. I actually love their SummerSlam 89 match a lot. Easily their best match together. But here at WrestleMania, Warrior goes to suplex Rick Rude back into the ring. Rude's on the apron. And in mid-suplex, Bobby Heenan reaches and grabs the Warrior's foot. And he trips him up. Rude falls on top of Warrior. Meanwhile, Heenan is holding down the Warrior's foot from the outside. Referee doesn't see it, or clearly does, and does a poor job of pretending that he doesn't. And he counts to three. And Rick Rude wins the Intercontinental Championship. This was a huge upset at the time. I would dare say even shocking to a young fan like myself. Because the Warrior just did not lose on television. That just didn't happen. He had never lost before on TV. Let alone by pinfall. I mean, he may have had count-out losses. I know he had a bunch of count-out losses at house shows and stuff. I can tell you, though, again, as a kid at the time, this was a shocking outcome. Warrior beat up Bobby Heenan when the match was over. He went to give him a gorilla press slam. He botched it one of many times, I'm sure, that Warrior hurt Heenan. It's no wonder that Heenan hated Warrior's guts so much. Then again, this is the same Ultimate Warrior who once reveled in the fact that Bobby Heenan had cancer. because Bobby Heenan said mean things about him, so he celebrated the fact that the cancer was eating away at his body. Fuck the Warrior. It's worth noting that the Warrior suffered his first pinfall loss, on or off television, to Rick Rude. Just not on the show. His first pinfall loss actually dates all the way back to a match that he and Rude had in December of 1987, December 28th to be exact. It was at a house show in Richmond, Virginia. There was a pinfall loss, and after that, Warrior suffered two more pinfall losses off TV before this WrestleMania. Actually, I can't even say off TV. That's not true. The first one that was technically televised, although it wasn't in this country, was a pinfall loss in Italy that did air, I believe, on Italian television. And that was to Andre the Giant. And the other one was in a match non-televised to Dino Bravo in Montreal, both of which I believe came in 88, I want to say. And that one, the loss to Dino Bravo, was with the assistance Bravo had from holding the rope. But the loss to Andre was just straight up fair and square. Pin right by the ropes. Andre just sat on him, which is funny because Andre held onto the ropes, which technically should be a rope break, but it's Andre, so what are you going to do? And he sat on him and he pinned him. You can find the clip on YouTube. It's rare. It's the only known footage of it anywhere. But I'm pretty sure it did air on Italian television. Rick Rude did not like the Ultimate Warrior. Shocking, I know. But they had worked together in World Class when he was still the Dingo Warrior. In WWE, they weren't exactly friendly either, although Rude always sold Warrior's offense great. He made Warrior look like $1 million. I still say that the best ever to sell the effects of the atomic drop, I mean, I guess you could, some people might say it was comically bad and you couldn't take it seriously. I thought that Rude was great. Every time he would sell the atomic drop. Nobody sold that move like Ravishing Rick Rude did. But some quick stories here about these two. Bruce Pritchard, on his podcast, said that Rude really did rough up the Warrior more than a few times when they were in the ring together. I guess stiffed him or whatever. Because he didn't like him. But he tells the story of the Warrior whenever he would work with Andre the Giant. This was probably after Andre roughed him up, because Warrior was probably just wild and whatever, but he worked a lot with Andre. And Warrior would come into the dressing room on a night where he was going to work with Andre, and he would give Andre a bottle of French wine every single night. He would give him a bottle of French wine because he was so afraid of Andre beating the shit out of him every night that he would kiss his ass by buying him a bottle of wine. Well, Rude saw this, according to Pritchard, and he was very upset because here he is, having worked with this guy, busting his ass, trying to help him get over. He never bought Rude a bottle of wine. I think Bruce's quote from the conversation that he claims he had with Rude, Rude's exact words were, "I didn't even get a bottle of Gatorade from this motherfucker." I get the sense that Rick Rude just really did like the Warrior and would have loved to have just kicked his ass. And in fact, he did once. There's two different versions of the story floating around, though, so pick the one that you want to believe. In one version, while the two of them were working together, this would have been in 89, Rude came backstage after one of their matches together, and he asked the Warrior to, hey, lighten up. Because, you know, I guess he was working stiff or whatever. And the Warrior, as the story has it, shot back with, "I don't have to." Basically implying, "I'm the Ultimate Warrior, you're not the star that I am, and so I don't have to do shit." And Rude dropped him with one punch. Punched him right in the face. The other version of this comes directly from Ric Flair. Back when Flair had his podcast, I think it was the one with Conrad, Woo Nation or whatever it was called. Which lasted, I think, all of 5 minutes. He claims that there was an incident at a show in Savannah, Georgia. This would have been in 89 or 90, when the two of them were working together. Now, if it was during the Warriors' WWF title run, it would have had... I looked this up, I was curious, so I went and I looked up every show from 1989, 1990. I'm looking for a Savannah, Georgia house show. with a match between Rick Rude and the Ultimate Warrior. And the only thing I was able to find, there was a Savannah, Georgia house show on August 24th, 1990, which would have been right around the time, maybe right before SummerSlam that year. And they had a match. They had a cage match at SummerSlam. So they were probably working together. But there's no card. It's like the only, it annoys the crap out of me. It's the only house show date that doesn't have a card listed. So I have no idea who was on the show, who worked who. So anyway, by process of elimination, it might have been that show. Flair claimed that the Warrior made a derogatory remark about Rude's wrestling ability. Which is, I mean, holy shit. I mean, the Ultimate Warrior talking shit about somebody else's wrestling ability. Talk about a lack of self-awareness. Rude walked across the room after he heard the comment, and he beat him up real good. This is according to Flair. Now, Flair wasn't in WWE at the time. Obviously, he was told this secondhand, but that's Flair's version of events as it was explained to him. So, depending on who or what you believe, Rude either dropped the Warrior with one punch, or he beat him up pretty badly in some sort of extended beatdown. Believe what you will. The point is, Rick Rude was no fan of the Ultimate Warrior. They did, as I said, work together in 90 again for the WWF title. They had a cage match at SummerSlam that year. A few months later, Rude was gone from the company. He had a money dispute with Vince McMahon. I think he was out hurt. He had a neck injury. They were still promoting his name on the advertising for some of the live events. He got smart to it. He felt that he should get a piece of, I guess, the gate. He should get paid something for it. Because back then, if you didn't work, you didn't get paid. None of this guaranteed contract bullshit. Well, apparently Vince disagreed. He didn't agree with that sentiment. And that was the end of Rick Rude in the WWF, at least the first time. Now, at the time, Rude was feuding with the Big Boss Man. This is when Bobby Heenan was making fun of the Boss Man's mother on television and calling her all sorts of names. And so in the middle of this, Rude leaves. And it's interesting to think about if the plan for WrestleMania 7, let's just say, if the plan had been Rick Rude against the Big Boss Man, which it probably was, who faces Mr. Perfect then at WrestleMania for the IC title? Turned out to be the Boss Man. But if not the Boss Man, then who? Texas Tornado? He had already been pushed out of that spot. You know, they got the belt on him, and boy, did they get that belt off him quickly. So I don't think it would have been him. Who would it have been? I have no idea. But anyway, there's number 10 in the countdown. Most shocking WrestleMania match outcomes. Rick Rude and the Ultimate Warrior from WrestleMania 5. We'll do one of these every week for 10 weeks straight through until the day of WrestleMania 35 with the number one spot. These segments, much like the Rumble ones that I was doing, are going to be posted up on the YouTube channel every Wednesday. I will archive them there. I'll put them in a playlist so that when this wraps up, everything will be organized and you can refer back to these lists very easily. In a playlist on the channel. So that's how I plan to do these going forward. You can subscribe on YouTube. Just type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll find the official channel. We are getting very close to 47,000, soon to be 50,000 subs on there. So please hit the subscribe button. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. I'm out of here. If you are going to be watching the Super Bowl, enjoy the big game. Or the commercials, or if you're not watching, then as I'm sure many of you won't be, enjoy Halftime Heat. That should be fun. And don't forget, House of Glory, Jamaica, Queens, next Saturday. I will be there. It should be a fun show. Maybe I'll get to see some of you guys there. And I will see you next Sunday for episode 585 of the Sound Off. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. Enjoy the big game. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows.
It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off?